Tonight on The Download, actor Michael Shannon, Second City director and Annoyance Theater founder Mick Napier, and music from Chicago's Hood Internet. And now, here's your host, a man who thinks it's high time for Chinese checkers to make a comeback, Justin Kaufman.
Laugh. Laugh all you will. But I'm telling you, that's the best game in the world. I should know I won like seven times this weekend. Lull them in. Lull them in. And then attack. A triple move. Oh, Chinese checkers. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on WGN Radio. Hope you had a good weekend, but it's time to get back to business. Only a few weeks left till we all shut down for the holiday break, so let's use this time wisely. Tonight on the show, Alderman Will Burns joins me to talk about the presser today, asking the DOJ to expand their investigation not only to excessive force, but to minority hiring. For a long time, black aldermen have been complaining to the powers that be that the police exam is rigged and the applicants of color are passed over intentionally. We'll talk with him about that issue and whether or not he thinks the DOJ investigation will bring any good to Chicago. Also, Obama, Trump, Muslims, oh my. The political rhetoric is heating up and it's only Monday. Perfect night for our regular segment, Touché, where Roebling and Lundy argue about politics. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's not the leather bar in Rogers Park, it's Touché. It's our new political segment that we do. I like to do it more than regularly. I like to do it weekly as we get heated up here. And I like it mostly because of the big words that Roebling likes to throw out. It's like a drinking game. A word you don't understand, and Chris Roebling says you take a shot. Tonight we got some star power in the building. Chicago actor and probably eventually an Oscar winner. It doesn't matter for what. He's just going to get an Oscar. He's that good. Michael Shannon joins us to talk specifically about his days in Chicago theater and why he keeps coming back. He lives in Brooklyn now. He's on stage right now at the Red Orchid in Old Town. We'll talk to him later in the show. And my guest tonight at the big table is none other than improv director, teacher, and Annoyance Theater founder Mick Napier. Napier's directed some of the biggest shows in Second City history, and he's become the go-to when it comes to improv teaching and theory. We're going to talk to him about his new book, Behind the Scenes, and his career here in Chicago. All that, plus DJ Collective Hood Internet, one of the best mashup DJ duos in all of music, and they're back in town for an event this week before they go back on tour. They're stopping by the studio. Very excited about that. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Eric Solomon. Production, of course, provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download. All right, let's get things started so we can have a use our time wisely. It's time for the carry out, our nightly segment where, of course, I read the newspaper so you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Wow, the Chicago Police Department's more prolific than Drake. It's like a viral video every 2 weeks. Good for them. No charges filed against the police officer who shot and killed Ronnie Johnson on the South Side a year ago. Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez walked reporters through why there were no charges filed. Evidence points to Johnson having a gun in his hands. But one thing's for certain, I'm afraid that we may have ourselves a new genre here. Police shootings caught on tape. It's got UPN written all over it. It's really taking the cops genre, that great reality show that showed a bunch of people without shirts on trying to hide drugs in their junk, to a whole new level. Will this be the new norm? Find out Tuesday at 8. In other related news, the Justice Department is looking into the Chicago Police to see if there are ways to improve the system. They aren't looking specifically at the Laquan McDonald case. They're looking at excessive force and whether or not there's evidence of racial bias. Yeah, well, we see how that worked out in other cities. My guess, more training with bagels and fruit plates and trust falls, maybe a dry erase board. Hey, maybe even the oversized Post-it notes. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Those are expensive. I don't know how the DOJ rolls, but because of all the trauma, I believe Chicago is due oversized Post-it notes. Several black aldermen in town want the Justice Department to look into minority hiring practices as well. Since you're already there, it's like a mechanic. You know what? Take a look at the oil. Since I don't know, the brakes are acting up too. Just while you're there, look at it all. Highland Park beat the system. Yes! The Supreme Court won't take the case that essentially says that certain cities and towns can't have their own gun ban. So Highland Park's ban on assault weapons stands. Can't wait to read the new town sign. Highland Park banning rich white people with assault weapons since 2014.
Ted Cruz has surged ahead of Donald Trump in Iowa, and that's good because that means that Trump will dial it back and approach his campaign with a more measured... Oh, who am I kidding? Hours after the new polls, Trump proposes a moratorium on Muslims entering our country. Ah! Darn it, I should have passed. I knew I should have passed. I saw Cruz and Trump in that one, and I should have passed. Ugh. Let's get to some sane news today, huh? Maybe cycle to the middle of the paper, you know? Maybe when there's a hard-hitting expose we need to read about. Oh, here we go. Kim Kardashian and Kanye West named their new baby boy Saint. Saint West. To be Saint, don't you have to be, like, dead and a former pope or something like that? Saint West. So Saint's like the new doctor? Just Dr. Dre, Saint West. I think I speak for everybody out there, but I want to thank the Kardashian West family for birthing a new celebrity. We needed one. Appreciate it. In weather, gloomy, like the skies waiting to make a move. In sports, the Bears got us to the early part of December. After an embarrassing 0-3 start, the Bears made it interesting and even got their logo on all the In the Hunt graphics on pregame shows. But no more. The Bears lost at home to the lowly 49ers, proving that this Bears team is going to play every team tight, good or bad. I guess that makes for fun football, or at least more drinking when you watch, but you know what else it means? No playoffs. The Cincinnati Bengals don't play the bad teams tight. They beat them. The Bears are 5-7 and just about done. The defense played well, except for the lapses at crucial times. The offense played okay, except for the lapses at crucial times. The special teams, well, they're just one big lapse. Upside, like I said, they made it interesting till early December. After the first couple weeks, I thought this fall would be a series of Sundays where I rake leaves, learn a new language, maybe take up woodworking. So thanks to the Bears for saving me from bettering myself. In other sports news, Patrick Kane broke the record for most consecutive points. Right now, the Hawks are playing, breaking records and playing 500 hockey. Weird combo. In college football, Michigan State goes to the Final Four of football. I still need a name for that. And the local stories, Notre Dame's going to play Ohio State in the Battle Frog Fiesta Bowl. Really ruined the name of that bowl game. And the Outback Bowl, Northwestern gets Tennessee. So not bad for the locals. NIU's getting Boise State in the Poinsettia Bowl. And the Illini, they're going to play nobody. No bowl game for you. No. Absolutely not. No. And finally, Google Calendars has a new feature that nags you to go to the grocery store. Jeez. You know what? Let me know if it nags you to change that light bulb and also lose 25 pounds. Google, forcing you to think about how much your life sucks. Well, that's the carry out for December 7, 2015. Hey, we're experimenting with peppermint. You ever had peppermint beef stew? You should try it. Yeah, try it.
Just some of the headlines making news today. Coming up, Alderman Will Burns going to join us to talk about the DOJ investigation, whether or not to expand that to minority hiring for the police. Also, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Touche! Coming up after the news. Stay with us. It's The Download. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Today, select African-American aldermen held a press conference to urge the Department of Justice to not only look into the CPD for the civil rights violations, but to also look at minority hiring. Aldermen have complained to the police brash about the disparity between hiring white officers versus, hiring officers of color. Former police chief Gary McCarthy had brushed the complaints aside, saying they were quote-unquote absurd. But there are truth to the numbers. The department has about 12,000 officers, and 52% white, 23% black, 22% Hispanic. This, of course, according to the police officer spokesperson. Fourth Ward Alderman Will Burns was at the presser today, and he joins me now on the line. Alderman Burns, thanks for coming back.
Thank you so much for having me, Justin.
So let's talk about, first off, what's your reaction to the idea that the Department of Justice is going to look into the Chicago Police Department?
I think it's a really important step to restore confidence in the community, in the police department. I think that, you know, quite frankly, Chicagoans are very cynical about city government. There have been a lot of allegations of a cover-up, and I don't think that those allegations are true, but... You know, having an independent investigation into the pattern and practices of the Chicago Police Department could go a long way to coming up with some concrete recommendations that the city will have to enact, which I think will be a good thing for the city and for the police department.
One of the things that has always been bantied about is making a police force look more like the community that it serves. That you've seen this in other police experts and others talking about more minority representation can be a good thing from the police department. Do you think that the police department as it stands now has been rigging the system to keep officers of color out?
Well, so I think there are two things. One is that I have heard concerns about racial bias in tests to become a Chicago Police Department officer. And so that was a question I asked former Superintendent McCarthy during the budget hearings. I did receive some information from different lawyers, law firms that are looking into this issue, and I think it's certainly something that we need to look into. On the other hand, we need to also step up our efforts to make sure that African-American and Latino officers are folks are applying to become officers with the Chicago Police Department, because you can't become an officer if you don't apply. And so my office, we're getting information out about the tests, and my hope is that, you know, the recent dash cam videos that have been released encourage more people of color to want to become officers in order to make sure that the police department is reflective of the broader mm-hmm. community.
Well, I mean,
historically, though, I will say the police department has done a better job at diversity than the fire department.
Right. And just recently, there was a, you know, just in the last 2 months, I think it has been that there was a push from the mayor and the former police chief to address that issue with new rounds of testing. But it is, I mean, the former CPD retired officers, minority officers came forward, said it's a system, that there's trouble with the system. There's trouble with the corrupt system. It really does play, it's not balanced. And can a Department of Justice investigation help balance that?
Well, it'll be part of so they're supposed to be looking at violations of civil rights law. And certainly if you have a system where if the allegation that African-American and Latino officers are not becoming sergeants or lieutenants or moving up the ranks, that would certainly be part of a pattern and practice of discrimination, and the Justice Department would have recommendations on how to mm-hmm. how to address that. I certainly think that a lot of it, you know, will depend on who the superintendent of the Chicago Police Department is, and the values that person will bring to the office in terms of inclusion and diversity. And I think that message comes from the top.
Does, you know, in your eyes, there's been talk about, you know, who that next person is going to be from your office. Do you want that person to be African-American?
What I want is somebody who can restore confidence in the police department, someone who can be outward facing and work with the entire city. And I think that's really, really important. You know, a lot of times in this town, it's not about what you do, it's how you do it. So I could be giving out rainbows and lollipops, but, you know, if I'm surly about it or if I'm off-putting in a personal way about it, then it makes it much more difficult for people to be happy about me giving out rainbows and lollipops.
Let me ask you this as we wrap up. I'm interested in what you know, it's different than a task force. A task force is going to come in and give recommendations, and you could easily put that up on the shelf and let it collect dust. The Department of Justice comes in, and there's a decree that says it has to be implemented, or they'll watch and there'll be fines and other things because it's a violation of civil rights. What do you think can come from this, from a Department of Justice inquiry or investigation that can be implemented in the city of Chicago?
Well, so first of all, I think we have to understand that this is a sort of a fluid process, right? And so the Justice Department is going to send out people, they're going to talk to folks, they're going to look at data. But a lot of what will end up being their final recommendations will depend on what we do as a city between now and the time they come up with the report. So they may say in 2016 we see these issues. But also in 2016, city council and the mayor and police department moved to make reforms independently of the Justice Department and to enact them. Those issues may have been addressed before the Justice Department comes out with its final recommendation. So even though we have this independent review, our fate is still in our own hands, and there's a lot that we can continue to do. I'm really excited about new leadership at IPRA. I'm excited about, you know, the potential new leadership in the police department, and I really see a lot of people coming together in the city council, mayor's office, community, to really drive systematic reforms to the Chicago Police Department in a way I don't think we've seen in the city in a very long time.
Fourth Ward Alderman Will Burns, thank you so much for joining us in the download tonight.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, so much to discuss in American politics today. And I mean, today, Monday. I mean, and that doesn't even include what's happening here in Chicago. Mayor Emanuel took to the podium late this afternoon. Anita Alvarez spent most of the day defending why a police officer was not going to be charged for the shooting death of Ronnie Johnson. And the DOJ, well, they're just, it's another typical week. They're investigating Chicago. What a month. And what a month. So let's touche.
Touche.
I don't know if that worked. That's what we decided to call this regular segment. Touche. Thanks to our lovely listener who I think was awarded a Lou Malnati's pizza. Although I will say he reached out to me. He's like, I haven't got that pizza yet. And I was like, oh, man.
Wait. The listener got the pizza. What do we get?
We get
the warm glow of victory.
I get the warmth of Roebling.
Touche,
I mean,
guys. Touche. You got me.
How's that work? Yeah?
Dave Lundy, Democrat analyst, Republican analyst, Chris Roebling, back in studio.
Hello.
Touche, as I said, to thrust and parry. I want to bring back some more fencing terms. Let's talk with the story. We have not had a chance to talk yet about the fallout from the Laquan McDonald video, the possible political cover-up. This stuff, I mean, this is crazy.
What a mess.
What do you guys make of it today as this story continues to evolve?
You know, Justin, Chicago always wants to consider itself the center of the universe. Today, we were and we have been. This is so depressing. And what's so depressing about it is not just where we are, but what's still to come out. I mean, in the McDonald case, the cover-up and the police cover-up is so outrageous. And these cops are still on the beat who wrote these lies in these reports. And you got to ask the question, how many of these are out there? And that's my feeling, is that when the feds come in here and they really start scraping and scratching, geez, it scares the bejesus out of me.
And not to forget, the Attorney General of the United States today held a press conference in which she described the pattern and practice investigation in which DOJ will engage probably for the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And this picking up, I think she said, I read Randy Sanborn's op-ed in the Tribune that said we should do this, so I'm here.
Randy's a star.
A friend of
Randy's
all
Randy's a star.
He's a star. You know, he writes and the AG flies. Anyway, let's say this. If you're in the sound of my voice, there is no way to see this and not understand it as an abject failure of government across any number of categories. And not to get personal about Rahm, and just leave that all aside for a second. Government has profoundly failed, and people need to really internalize that and to really understand if you keep doing the same stuff, you're going to get the same results. And that, I think, is the big lesson here. No matter what was said in the window dressing or the press conference or the, you know, whatever ceremony there was, basically the same stuff got done, and we're getting the same horrid results, and we're having another conversation about race and the police department. In my lifetime, this has got to be the 18th or the 23rd. I've lost count. It's terrible.
Dave, what do you think? I mean, do heads have to roll? I mean, we saw Superintendent McCarthy, and now there's still a lot of pressure on Anita Alvarez, and even some pressure and continuing to mount on Rahm Emanuel. Do you see a future in which those two individuals are not holding office in their respective areas?
Well, Anita Alvarez, absolutely. I think the chance of her winning her primary is somewhere between slim and the Bears completing a pass into the end zone. I mean, she's toast. And you know, the other day on Chicago Tonight, in her defense, she said, "Well, the average time from shooting to charge in the country with these police shootings is 256 days." And I sat there looking at the television, going, "Like, exactly. This was 400. You can do math. 400." More than 258. And so she's gone. I think, though, that the notion that the mayor is, as my friends at Politico said today, on political's, you know, death's door or last, whatever. I mean, come on, that's ridiculous. Rahm's not going anywhere. He's not going anywhere in any time in the near future.
Another Democrat friend of mine said to me on, I think, Saturday afternoon, evening on the phone, Rahm is hanging by a thread, and he should fall. Rahm should, if he had any real integrity, he would already have fixed this problem. But we know he didn't fix the problem. He doesn't have the integrity. Everything he told us about Gary McCarthy wasn't true, and he wasn't pushing Gary McCarthy to make those big assertions true. Now, I think he's got to go. I mean, I don't think that anybody in this city should stand for this guy. And it just, in my opinion, gets worse every day because he's doing the whole, I'm Rahm and I'm going to make it right. Hold on a second, Mr. Rahm. Why didn't you make it right the first time?
And yet, as a practical matter, we do not have the power of impeachment. We do not have the power of recall. We do not have the ability to do anything about it until the next election. So it really is an academic conversation because short of some unimaginable thing, I just see no eventuality where Rahm on his own says, you know what? Yeah, gosh darn, I messed up. I'm gone. It's just never going to happen. And frankly, it wouldn't happen with any politician.
No, that's not true. He should be the subject of appropriate.
Tell me a mayor who, upon thinking they did something wrong, voluntarily said, oh, golly, gee, you're right. I'm gone.
Honestly, David, you and other Democrats are enabling him.
How am I enabling him? By pointing out that we have no power of recall? If you feel strongly about that, let's work together. You and I work together and get recall put on the ballot so we can recall our elected officials. That I'm all over.
I care about the people of the city of Chicago having a mayor who cares enough to make sure that what he claims at the press conference with McCarthy upon bringing the guy in is actually physically happening. Here is an old Navy expression.
Buy cheap? Wait, what?
Right. No. The old Navy.
Oh, wrong Navy. Sorry. You meant U.S. Sorry. Navy.
Yeah, the Navy.
Anchors away. Right. Okay.
You're going to get what you inspect, not what you expect. And that is meant to say there is no one in a command position, whether it's a low-level commander or the captain of a ship, who is above checking out to see that the engine is actually working,
that's a good point. Torpedoes
or whatever the heck the Navy's got going. And here is Rahm. And it's not like the police department was low on his list. You know, after the NATO summit and all of that elan and momentum, first of all, McCarthy, and I said so at the time, he should have walked out of here on a cloud at that time. He could have been carried out of here in a chariot on a cloud. Instead, he hung around. And he has proven unable to deal with the intractable internal issues of the police department, and so is Rahm.
Yeah, well, I mean, they can't argue with that. And at the same time, you know, it's hard to say that any superintendent, and that might be a bigger, maybe we can take a break and talk about that, about the Chicago way, which is getting thrown around a lot. I've heard that a lot about sort of the system, the democratic machine, and nothing can change. No politicians are going to be able to affect because these are people. And they're looking out for themselves instead of looking out for the people.
Join
the Republican Party.
We're open.
Yeah, that's going to work.
We need you. You're going to make us stronger.
Yes, just look at Governor Rauner. It's working like a charm.
Yeah.
All right. Chris Roebling, Republican analyst. Dave Lundy, Democrat analyst. Let's take a break. We come back. More of Touche. It is The Download here on WGN, and it is time for Touche, part two.
Touche.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Republican analyst, Democrat analyst, a segment we do regularly. I'd like to do it weekly. Let's make that happen, guys. There's so much to talk about on both sides of the aisle. Let's turn our attention to national politics. Another mass shooting, this one at the hands of terrorists in San Bernardino, California. You know, last week I thought it really blew up the Twitterverse, the idea that the day that there was really a call for some sort of measured government reaction to guns and to this mass shooting, what we got instead was Speaker Ryan and his first speech and his first collective thought saying, repeal Obamacare. That's what happened. Chris, why don't we start with you? Do you see that a lot? It really felt tone deaf in the sense that guns are becoming one of the bigger issues in American culture right now.
Okay. I guess my theory would be the following. After that horrid, horrible terrorist act in San Bernardino and the loss of those innocent lives and the injuries to those people, after all of that, it was time for somebody to come up and say, here's what we're going to do. And instead, we had a president who's tone deaf go on national television for one of the very few times. And not to say he shouldn't for something like this. That part's fine. But he got on there and I thought he was as confused and as out of his element and as unconnected to reality as could possibly be. And I, you know, I don't think that the world at large, I think literally the liberal elite and all of the journalists and the activists and the Democratic Party and jazzing up the Democratic base, that's all about guns. I think the regular people in America say, what are we doing to protect ourselves from this ISIS? We have failed to fight it there. It's now killing us here. President Obama, what are you going to do? And he's on there saying, we're going to use Libya as an example. Yeah, of course, he didn't say that. I'm kidding. But he is on there talking about a reality that exists only in his head.
You know, it's a curious phenomenon. Number one, let the record reflect, Chris did not answer your question. Touche! number two, the president got in there. He said, this is a terrorist act. He went on television. He said, this is about violence. These people are thugs. We have a strategy. Here's what we're doing. But here's what we're not going to do. We're not going to send a massive ground invasion. And Chris and his right-wing friends went absolutely out of their minds, even though it's what Robert Gates said. You know, you guys like
I'm
to quote.
I'm not for an invasion.
Okay, well, fine. Chris did.
Touche.
Touche. His friends did.
Cannot get it.
Oh, yeah. This is going to just keep going. Yeah. You got to get it on a little, like a push a button. Yeah.
Stantis will
exactly.
love this when he gets
touche. but a lot of the folks on the right are like, well, how dare you not talk about a new strategy?
No.
And the thing is, Chris, the thing that you like to ignore is that while you don't like the speed with which Obama is executing the strategy and the bombings, and I agree, and you know you and I agree on that, I have not heard anybody come up with a strategy that involves a more effective approach other than the no-fly zone.
Hold on. I mean, not that this is my, I'm not, nobody's bringing me to the Pentagon to come up with ideas, but number
Thank
one,
God.
You know, you take out the source of their $3 to $5 million a day. So you wipe out the oil operation.
Agreed.
That has been, the reason President Obama hasn't done that is, quote, for environmental concern. Well, I'm pretty, none of the people in San Bernardino, and this is a horror, no one out there is going to be enjoying the environment any longer. So what are we talking about? Number two, that he has got to have an integrated force with a limited but significant, far more than 250 American presence to do all of the, not just the bomb damage assessment, but they've got to do the forward planning for the bombing. And number three, you are going to have to say, we are taking ISIS out where it is.
Which is what he said.
It's not what he has done. And what is so offensive about that speech last night, he's talking about working for a ceasefire in Syria. This is from the same guy.
No, he's talking about a political solution to get Assad out, because otherwise Assad isn't going anywhere.
I'm sorry. He said ceasefire. Okay. That's his word. Just like red line. Remember red line in the Syrian sand? He said ceasefire.
Red rum.
I want to tell you something. Where are you going to get a ceasefire in Syria? Answer, nowhere. This is the very same administration that there's nobody to deal with in Syria. Now he's going to have somebody fly over and negotiate a ceasefire. This guy is out of touch with reality. And the fundamental issue is his plan has failed to work. And that's shown by the fact that these guys are mounting attacks in Egypt, in the United States, in France. We've got things going on in Belgium.
This is not my area of expertise, and I love talking to you guys. But I find it hard to believe that one man or one administration, whether it be Republican or Democrat, can stop terrorist attacks in different foreign countries. We've seen it throughout history. It happens. How does one with a new administration approach something like this that's so hard to your hand on?
I think you have a larger issue here. And I was thinking about this morning in all seriousness. We don't understand ISIS. We don't understand the mentality of a human being who looks at other human beings who are just enjoying their holiday party and says, we want to slaughter those people.
Right,
but that's terrorism. That's been around for a while. But ISIS is something different. We don't get it. We fundamentally don't understand the motivations.
Obama doesn't get it.
No, forget it.
The rest of us
don't get it. No, you don't get it. You don't understand that. You cannot get in the psyche of some of these people and understand why, for example, an American born in Chicago suddenly becomes an ISIS terrorist. And the problem that we have here, and this is what you do not have an answer of how to deal with, is how do you get the ISIS-motivated terrorists, the people like Farouk, who was born in Chicago? Because I got news for you. There are probably dozens and hundreds of those guys, and they're not on anybody's radar.
Chris, last words.
Well, I think that, first of all, those who have studied Islam are well aware of the rejectionists who evidence themselves not 45 or 50 years after the death of the prophet, may peace be upon him. And so you've got there is a vast storehouse of knowledge, David, and I'm sure you're far more acquainted with it than you're letting on just now for your political purposes. Number two, touche. Number two, I'm going to say this. There, if you destroy ISIS, if you go about and you absolutely extirpate ISIS in certain sectors, that is the single best thing you can do to decrease recruitment.
Extirpate. I'll take that. That's a drinkable for everyone.
You need to bring the bell.
Bell. Yeah. I need Rose Bell. Ding,
ding.
Extirpate gets you a shot on Touche here. You guys, time's up. A great round of Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy. I'm serious, guys. This is. I love hanging out with you guys, and I think the listeners do too. We'd love to have you back.
Are they okay? I mean,
they're not okay.
Yeah.
They're not okay right now. They're like, get these guys gone. Both these guys. No. Actually, I think it's great. I think we could expand and take some calls and get people involved, because there's people that are interested in having a conversation with Chris and Dave here on The Download. Chris Roebling, Dave Lunding, until next time, touche.
Touche.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, in studio with me tonight at the big table, one of the co-founders of the Annoyance Theater, Chicago's great underground comedy theater, and a man who has been involved with some of Chicago's greatest comedy performances. Mick Napier directed Second City reviews like Citizen Gates and Paradigm Lost, which included an all-star lineup of now A-list talent, Tina Fey, Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch, just to name a few. Throw in Stephen Colbert, Amy Sedaris, the Annoyance alums like Jeff Garlin, Andy Richter, Jill Soloway, and Jon Favreau, and younger talent now working on shows like SNL and in late-night TV like A.D. Bryant, Vanessa Bayer, and Connor O'Malley. And I've just named a sliver of the talent that Mick has helped develop, although he'll tell you he had nothing to do with it. Mick Napier, welcome to The Download.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You really don't. I mean, it's a sliver of the people you've worked with over the years. I mean, it's been decades of working with talent that now entertain the masses, but you don't take credit for their successes.
I don't really know. I mean, I do believe that I've had an influence here and there and a touchstone along the way, but I certainly am kind of anti-taking credit about people's, you know, successes and stuff.
We rarely see a class that you would teach in Chicago that says, maker of the stars. You know, you're not that kind of teacher that's like, I can get you on TV.
No, I'm really not that kind of teacher, and I don't revere teaching in that way. I look at it in a different way.
So let's talk about that. When did you come to Chicago?
I think in 1986.
So in 1986, when you came to Chicago, what was the comedy landscape like here? I mean, we know it now to be Second City, Annoyance, I.O., other theaters, and a very robust place for improv and sketch comedy. But what was it like in 1986?
Well, I think it was a very scaled-down training program at Second City, for sure. I think they had just started having around 5 levels, and right before I started, they had around 3 or 4, I believe. And then I.O. was only 5 years old. So I believe there were about 5 teams, and I was lucky enough to get on one of them. And we were all housed together at a place called Cross Currents, which doesn't exist, over at Belmont and Wilton, oddly enough, about a block from where the Annoyance Theater is right now. And that's where the Annoyance started, in Cross Currents Cabaret, and that's where Sharna had one of her first permanent places with I.O. as well. But it was very, very small back then.
You know, I've talked to different people on the show. Greg Allen from the Neo-Futurist once talked about that Belmont and Clark area in the 80s, the late 80s. Ira Glass had talked a lot on his shows, Wild Room and This American Life, about the epicenter of just counterculture that was happening in the 80s at Belmont and Clark.
Absolutely. You know, they had just tore down what was called the Punkin' Donuts, which was because all the punk kids and goth kids would hang out there. And a lot of runaway kids would just show up around Sheffield and Belmont. And we were running a show back then called Splatter Theater. It's a blood show that we run every week. Every year at Halloween now. So it drew a lot of weirdos and misfits and kind of freakish people. And it still has that quality about it, which I really like a lot. And now that we're at Belmont and Clark, I couldn't be happier. It really is the perfect place for us.
Talk about starting The Annoyance. What was the impetus to do that? Because it's one thing to get into improvisation or to try and move up and be at Second City, but it's another thing entirely to start your own theater company.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And I didn't really know what I was doing at all, certainly business-wise and financially, all of that. But it started because we were having dinner at Leona's, some friends of mine, and we were wanting to do Splatter Theater. And it was September 10th, that we decided to open it on October 10th.
Sure.
And I kind of by default became the director of it. I never really studied directing or anything, but it was my idea, and I just kind of had that, I guess, that fortitude to want to get it done. So we opened Splatter Theater. Then we created another show called Coed Prison Sluts, which ran for 11 years here in Chicago, and we still run it on New Year's Eve every year. And then after we did that, we just decided to have, we wanted to have a building. So we started searching for places, and we actually called the building The Annoyance, and our company was called Metroform, but now we're known as The Annoyance Theater.
Why did you choose that area? Because where you guys were at, you said Belmont and Wilton.
Yeah, that's where Metroform was. When we created The Annoyance, we were actually at, I believe, Broadway and
by the old Domino's.
Breyer, yeah, somewhere in there. And there was an A-frame house on top of this building, and I lived there, and 60 people had keys to this place. And every morning there was someone, you know, new sleeping there. And it was crazy, and we did lots of stuff, and it had a deck, and it was insane and fun and all of that. And I was around 27, I think, when we did that. And like I said, I didn't know what I was doing. I got in a whole lot of financial trouble that lasted an entire decade.
Just for rent and buying things and getting in debt.
Property taxes and just a lot of stuff I didn't know about then that I know a lot more about now. After having, I guess, this is our sixth location now.
You know, I remember being in college. I guess it would have been like early 90s, like maybe 1990, 1991, going to see Annoyance Theater. And the vibe was one that you see a lot. You see it with, I mentioned the neo-futurists, same kind of thing. Lines around the corner, people trying to get in because they wanted to see the counterculture, the alternative comedy, the underground comedy that was happening in Chicago on Broadway at that time.
Yeah.
When did you realize that The Annoyance was a hit?
Well, I think when Coed Prison Sluts started selling out in our first building, The Annoyance, another big indicator was the heyday of the Real Life Brady Bunch, which Jill Soloway put on The Annoyance stage, where she reproduced the Brady Bunch, merely reproduced it, not really parodied it, but we did it as best we could. I was Bobby. And looking back on that, I was quite reluctant to do it. We were going to do it for 2 weeks, and it ended up lasting for 2 years. It went to New York. It took Jane Lynch with it and Andy Richter. And it caused kind of a rift in our company at the time.
Why?
I think because half the people that were performing at The Annoyance then went to New York. And I had creative issues with it, like as a younger director, thinking that it wasn't really like an artistic venture because it was merely reproducing a television show. But I was also in it, so I kept, you know, having this crisis of conscience with it.
And it was a hit, so it's hard because the audiences were going crazy for it.
Absolutely. And I remember, you know, I ironically remember accusing Jill Soloway of not really being creative with it or not being a creator. And the irony lies in now that she's innovating television with Transparent. Everything that she's doing is
creator of Transparent.
Insanely amazing. So, yeah, I regard her as one of the most creative people on the planet at this point.
Well, so. I mean, you're going to run into that. I mean, any creative people that you've worked with over the years, I mean, like I just mentioned in the lead, there's so many people have moved on to bigger and better things. For you, talk about that relationship because, you're butting heads with somebody on off-loop theater. And then you see them changing the world on a stage with the Golden Globe going, I can only do this, you know.
Yeah, and it really is remarkable to see her do that and her sister. And the reason I know the Soloway sisters is from college. I had a group called Double Take, an improv group. And I actually formed an improv group before I had even performed or seen improvisation. I just wanted to do it so much. I had read Jeffrey Sweet's book, Something Wonderful Right Away, and it's a collection of interviews from Second City alumni, et cetera. And I became empowered to start a group and just held an audition, and Faith showed up at the audition. And that's how I got to know Faith, and then that's how I got to know Jill. And I'm very, very close to both of them now. And Faith writes on the show, and she's also a brilliant pianist. She can just play by ear anything.
We're talking with Mick Napier here on the Download. Of course, the co-founder of the Annoyance Theater, which is now at Belmont and Clark in its sixth location.
Yes, I think so.
Some of those, I have great memories of the building at Clark and Racine, Uptown.
Absolutely.
It feels like, you know, it's amazing to think it's been six different locations.
It is.
Let's continue the let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Mick Napier here on the Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Mick Napier.
Hello.
Longtime improviser, teacher, co-founder at the Annoyance Theater, which is at Belmont and Clark. You know, you went from being an improviser to being a director.
Yeah.
But the big thing that I think that people know you from is teaching. You've become sort of the master teacher of improvisation in Chicago, at least. And talk about that, because when did that transition happen for you from, like we just talked about, real life Brady Bunch and playing Bobby? When did you realize, you know what, I have a philosophy and I want to teach this philosophy?
I started teaching when I was at I.O. I decided I wanted to start teaching. And I got a clipboard with a piece of paper, blank lines on it. And I had people sign up if they wanted to be in this class. And it was $3 per person for my very first class. So I did get some people and taught my very first class, and that's what launched me into teaching. Teaching is so important to me. It's always been very important to me, and it's something that I'm very, very proud of with the Annoyance and the care that our teachers give there and how much we all are invested in wanting to empower people. And like I said before, I don't like to claim people as far as like the Annoyance, you know, because of our teaching, you're now famous, but I do like to think that we've had a healthy influence along the way.
What is your philosophy? Because, you know, there's always been two schools of thought in Chicago improv. There's always been the, and I always think of Bernie Sollins and Del Close, mm-hmm. where you have this Bernie Sollins where improv and getting up on stage and for people listening in WGN, you know, essentially quote unquote making things up as they go mm-hmm. with structure. Bernie always saw that to be a means to an end. That was practice almost, and the idea of putting together a show at Second City, where Del Close said, no, the art form is improvisation. With you and your philosophy, where do you stand on it?
I feel like that if human beings pay money to see other human beings improvise on a raised platform, it becomes a product, and therefore it's viable as its own art form. That doesn't mean it's going to be good, but it is, I think, an entertainment product. And I strive to make it a better entertainment product all the time. I have another book coming out about long-form improvisation, and its thesis is, to the improv community, let's treat long-form improvisation as an entertainment product as opposed to a process that an audience is forced to watch on stage.
Right. And far too often that does happen, where you see the process, and you're like, I don't know why I'm here.
That's right. And a lot of audiences are not educated enough to know what the experience that they're getting ready to enjoy or not enjoy, and they're not given a roadmap for what they're seeing. And I think that we in the improv community kind of take that for granted, and it makes for some often boring improvisation in long form. So it's a goal of mine to do that. I created a show called Trigger Happy at the Annoyance. It's Wednesdays at 10. It's a long form. And in it, the cast share a secret language, like either physical moves or verbal moves that the audience isn't privy to. And when the other cast members hear or see those triggers, then it triggers a series of choreographed events, like in transitions or whatnot. So you're just watching, and all of a sudden everyone in the cast just falls to the floor, and you don't know why they did that. Or everyone starts talking together, and you don't know why they did that. So I'm always striving to bring more elegance and more choreography and more showmanship to long-form improvisation.
Well, you see a lot in your career. I mean, you've performed in a lot, you've directed a lot, but you've seen a lot of improv.
I've seen a lot of improv.
When you go see an improv show, your random show at I.O. or Annoyance, and you sit in the audience, what's your expectation? Are you looking for, you know, as someone who's been involved, and are you looking for good technique? Are you looking for good process? Or are you open enough to be an audience member? It's like, I just want to be entertained, regardless of how you get there.
I think I'm really good at being an audience member if I have an expectation that the improvisation's going to be good. If I'm seeing Messing with a Friend, if I'm seeing TJ and Dave, then I have that expectation. I don't know if you heard about a show called Stolen Houses,
mm-hmm.
and it was a group of very, very good people.
Yeah,
Stephanie Weir, Bob Dassey, Scott Adsit.
TJ and Dave were in here talking
John
about
Lutz,
that.
John Lutz, TJ and Dave, And they took over a set of an existing play, and boy, that was probably the most brilliant improvisation I've ever seen in my life, and it was thoroughly enjoyable. My expectation, though, at random when I see improv is not that high. It's like, okay, here we go. I have a joke about improvisation. It's always different, and it's always the same. Because it does have a series of kind of familiar patterns and behaviors that people get into and they get trapped into. And it kind of is out of fear, and it prohibits them from making real daring choices and fun choices.
And that's part of improv, I think, for anyone who's listening who's not familiar or has seen improv before. Choices, that's a big part of the art form.
It is.
It's the choices that the improvisers on stage make.
Absolutely. And making courageous choices is very hard to do sometimes. And applying specificity to what you're improvising is also something that seems so simple but is very difficult to get to sometimes. Improvisation, it gets laughs for different reasons, and it's usually based in point of view and relationship or character. And it's not because you constructed a joke. So it's kind of a different way of looking at it.
Do improvisers seek you out? Do they say, you know what, I am having a hard time figuring out my choices on stage, or I feel like I'm stayed, and I'm looking for someone who is going to help me figure that out so I can go to the next level? Is that when they go and find a Mick Napier?
I think so. I certainly get asked a lot of questions.
You're not
about
doing
that.
Intro. You're not doing, you know, hey, it's intro. Here's your lawyer, and you're not
right.
Doing that kind of like intro to improv. No,
I'm not like getting dates for people and things like that. I hope I'm not. You know, I might be accidentally doing that. I think that people do seek not only me but the annoyance, because we have a reputation of being very individual with our assessments of people. My very first class of every class is to hear everyone's name and where they're from. And I've become good at memorizing names, and as a result of not being good at it for so long, I really wanted to become good at it. And the first thing I have them do is improvise for a half hour or so, and then I give every single person a set of individual notes about what I'm seeing, about challenges they might have in the next, you know, few weeks or whatever. So that's something that I'm very well known for, I think, and something I enjoy doing.
Absolutely. And yeah. I know I've had a lot of friends, and I was just reading some stuff about you about the way that you do give notes. No BS comes up a lot.
the idea
that, you know, you're real with the person and you tell them direct, honest feedback. And sometimes, I mean, it's not to hurt them, but it's not all. There are some teachers that I've had in my life who've tried to sugarcoat that.
Yeah.
But in your case, you're like, no, here's what you did. This is what you did wrong. This is what you need to work on.
Yeah. I try to be very direct. I try to be very honest. And I really want to be kind. And I really want to be affirming as well without BS. And it's a fine line in there sometimes.
How do people, I mean, you've had so many students over the years. How do people react to that?
I think people react pretty well. I think so. I think that they feel I think they feel relief that they were getting some honest feedback and that it provides something proactive for them to work on. So, because I just won't tell someone something wrong about them without telling them a remedy or something to work on.
Mick Napier in studio with me right now, the longtime improviser, teacher, director. You can see numerous shows at the Annoyance Theater Monday through Sunday.
Yep.
Let's take a quick break for the news, and we come back more with Mick Napier here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the big table rolls on, and my guest tonight, Mick Napier, longtime improviser, director, Paradigm Lost at Second City, is still considered one of the, we had Scott Adsit in here not too long ago, one of the best shows Second City's ever produced. And it continues to be. I mean, it continues, like when you read the books or anyone puts together a definitive history of Second City, people point to that show. Mick, why do they point to that show?
Well, I tell you, it was a great cast, and I was certainly felt strong enough and ready to make a difference with the structure of sketch comedy. And I think that it all came together in a really perfect way. It was Scott Adsit's third show. I think it was Tina Fey's second show. So it was just a really perfect harmony. It was also a strange experience for me, because I was doing what I called a journal at the time, and now it would be called a blog. And I was able to do a journal on the internet at a time when no one in the cast was on the internet. So they weren't
going to
be.
This was 1996, maybe 1997,
something like that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, not many people were on the internet. They had email or whatever.
So you were journaling the show as it was happening.
Absolutely, and that journal now is part of. I just had a second edition of my first book, Improvise, and that journal is included in there.
Wow,
it's really fun, and I remember just having a scotch every night and. You know,
did you know when you were putting that show together, and that show had Tina Fey, it had Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch, Kevin Dorff, Jim Zulovic,
yeah.
Did you know at that time was there a lot of fear involved? Because you were changing, I mean, Pinata Full of Bees kind of changed it already, but you were changing the sort of formula at Second City.
Yeah, I was, and providing a lot of exposed transitions and choreographing a lot of things that way. I didn't really know at the time, but I really was proud of it. It was also strange because it was being taped by HMS Media. They were doing a documentary, which became Second to None, which is a documentary of that entire process. So it was strangely being measured as we were doing it. Hmm. But it was great. You never know exactly who you're working with. I have students who ask me, like, what is it like working with, Steve Colbert? And I will say, it is exactly like working with you right now. And it is,
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Let's talk about the process, because you wrote about this. It was interesting about the idea that Second City in Chicago is part of an ecosystem in Chicago improv. So you have I.O., you have Annoyance, you have other independent theaters, you have a lot of improv in the back of bars, you have sketch comedy festivals.
Yep.
But for Second City, the idea being that this is the main draw, this is the one that brings in the big audiences. If you go to a show on a Friday or Saturday, Sunday night, anytime really, the house is packed, it's hard to get tickets. But there's always been this thing where inside the community they go, well, that's the safe comedy. Second City does a different broad. They're generic. It's not as cool. It's comedy, and I'm anti-comedy.
Yeah.
And you kind of write about the idea of why people say that and why that's there. And it's not necessarily about the performances, because some of the greatest performers and the comedy and the writers, it's really about the audience.
Yeah. It really is about the audience. Second City is one of the best places to work as a director, because the policy is that those stages are held sacred as far as the artists are creating in there. So it's rather producer-free. Even the owner, Andrew Alexander, will be very hands-off about a process. He might give a note here or two, but they're very, very hands-off. So it really is the director and the performers, and what you're seeing on stage is the voice of the actor, which I hold sacred as the director. So it's a very protected environment. And the reason that it sometimes gets that reputation is because of its audience base over the years. It has a 60% tourist-based audience. So those are people coming from all around. So if you do really weird, subversive comedy and you get absolutely no laughs at all, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you get no laughs
every time,
and it puts a big hole in the show that you have to recover from because there's no energy, do you keep doing that 8 times a week for 8 months in the run of the show? You don't. You try to get away with as much as you can and still do your job, which is to entertain the audience you have at hand.
And that's really what it's about. I mean, comedians, for stand-ups, for anybody, you have to recognize the audience that's in front of you. And a big part of Second City and sketch comedy and sketch comedians is being able to adjust.
Absolutely. I always say, that, like, you want to invite them to the party and make the audience feel safe and then push it as much as you can. And it never makes me feel good if I have, even with the Annoyance, for sure, if audiences leave, some people might like, we drove them out of here. And for me, it's like, oh, we drove them out of here. And that's a drag. I'd rather have them enjoy the experience. If we wanted to have them leave, then just have everyone come on stage, all the actors, and just say, get the F out of here, over and over and over until everyone leaves. And are you happy? I mean, I don't think that's a great time.
I think there is that push and pull for artists versus commerce, or even, we talked about a little bit of process and product, the concept of they're doing something that people can't understand, or I'm way ahead of you, you can't understand it, so you're leaving, that's your problem, not mine.
Yeah, I think that's a drag. I think that it's much more noble and takes a lot more energy, and it's much more courageous to create a context for an audience that they can enjoy, even if it's strange and weird and really outside of their outside of the box.
One of the great things about, I was reading your Tumblr, you put out tips. Yeah. But it wasn't necessarily tips like, here's what you do on stage. And that's what you hear a lot from improvisers, especially teachers, instructors. Here's yes and the different rules that are in improv. But this was about how to be a robust or rounded out improviser in terms of off stage.
Yeah.
So little things like, you're not always going to work with people you like.
That's
Which
true.
I think is a huge thing. People like get bent out of shape. I've seen a lot of actors like, I really don't like this person, and this is really going to affect me. But as you're saying, when you get to TV land, when you get to LA, New York, there are going to be a lot of people that you just don't like.
So many people that you don't like. And if you're at this scale, people do complain about people in their shows and stuff. I really hate this person. But if you were on a network television show, would you go to the producer and say, I don't really like my co-actor in the scene? Can we fire them? I guess some people do, but
yeah, right.
Yeah, but
But it's but the idea being that it's a lot about the business side of it. It's getting people prepared for their next move, that whether it be to L.A. or New York or here in Chicago. But a lot of what you do is preparing them that it's not just about how funny you are on a stage. It's about how your character plays off stage.
I think so. People become very seduced. They'll be on a team for 2 years, 3 years. Then they find out it's like 7 years and they haven't created a headshot or haven't visited an agent. And then their career is going away. But they get all of this kind of reinforcement at the tavern because they're on this team or they're in four shows a night.
You know? Or they're funny, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
All right. Yeah. So it takes a special kind of sense to get that you're also your own little business and everything. And this comes from failing at it miserably all my life. So
I don't know if you have failed at it. I mean, because through all that, you know, learning, it seems like you've learned along the way. And not just about what's creative, what's improv, what's property tax,
yeah,
and all those kind of things. For you to move throughout this career in Chicago improv, you have learned and you have adapted. And that's what makes you, Mick Napier, at the top of the improv community right now, that people want to work with you. I mean, I was talking to Pete before that a lot of these improvisers come through can read about Del Close.
Yeah.
Or they can read about Marty DeMott, or they can read about some of the teachers that have really made an impact on the people that we see. But they can actually take classes from Mick Napier. You have become this generation's Del Close.
That's, I don't know. I shirk at that, but I appreciate it at the same time. I try to make myself fairly accessible. Like, I'm at the Annoyance doing card tricks at night and stuff like that, and people will visit me. Some people are scared to visit me, which I welcome anyone to say hello. Business-wise, though, I have to shout out to my fiance, Jennifer Estlin, because there's no way that the Annoyance would exist if she hadn't kind of resurrected the business of it and everything. So that's helpful. I'm the artistic muse, I suppose.
You're the one with the card tricks at the bar.
I'm the one with the card tricks at the bar, getting a laugh here and there. I do kind of hate the phrase guru and all of that, yeah. And I always try to avoid that because I kind of fancy myself as a little more humble than that. I have a very working-class attitude about my life. My dad owned a construction company. I grew up in construction. I think that's sometimes why I'm so intolerant of the pretentiousness and delicateness of actors around me all the time.
Maybe that's why you stand out. I mean, maybe that's why people want to be around you, because there is that delicateness that rises to the top with a lot of instructors, a lot of professors, yeah. You know, where they're like, let me tell you about when I was on the stage.
Yeah.
And that's not your MO.
No, it is not at all.
Mick Napier in studio with me here on the download. We'll come back and let's talk about Chicago.
Okay.
Because you've done projects on the coast. You know, you go to L.A. to work on stuff. Exit 57, which we didn't even talk about, which is one of the greatest shows with Amy Sedaris and Stephen Colbert and Paul Dinello. But let's talk about why you're here, why you stayed here, and what you think of this town when we come back.
Okay.
Mick Napier, stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Mick Napier, longtime improviser, instructor, teacher, not a guru. We're not going to say guru. And director here in town. You said you came here in 1986, and for the most part, you've stayed here. I mean, for some projects, you've moved out to different cities to work on, Exit 57 in New York City, and projects, you know, all the time have you out in L.A.
Yep.
But what is it about Chicago that kept you here?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I do have a working class attitude. I think I could live in New York. We have another smaller theater in Brooklyn, like a 40-seat theater. So we've been traveling back and forth there a lot. And I love New York. But Chicago is kind of a working class town. And I learned how to live here and learned how to thrive here and not completely be poor or homeless. So, yeah. I just like it.
When it comes to the work, when it comes to the improv community, I mean, you talked about the modest beginnings of the Second City workshops in 1986, and I remember doing the conservatory in 1995, 1996.
Yep.
You think about it now.
It's crazy.
I mean, it's crazy. Thousands and thousands of kids pouring in here to learn the art of improvisation and work with you. So Chicago's changed when it comes to the improv community as well.
It has, and internationally it's different. UCB has gone, you know, just gone crazy, and their facility in L.A. is huge. I.O. is huge. Second City's doubling its training center. So it really is crazy right now, and there's no sign of it going backwards. I think thousands of people really want to get into the work for various reasons. So it's thriving right now for sure.
Is that a good thing for the Chicago improv scene that more and more people are coming here?
I think it's okay. It's kind of sad because there's probably an expectation among a lot of people that they're going to, you know, zip through here and get on SNL or whatever. And as the volume goes up, the numbers of talented people, you know, that percentage kind of goes down. So that becomes a little sad sometimes. But I think that there's certainly enough of a community to support the number of people that would want to be here.
Do you, as a director and as a teacher, do you see more of that when the numbers go up? Do you see, is it harder to develop talent or to spot talent because there's so many people coming through the door?
I think that it's not that hard because I only have a finite people in my class. So those are the people I see. I think I also have an advantage because I get to see really young talent at the Annoyance. And then also, since I run the Second City auditions, I can see a lot of people there. So that's just kind of a magnet for some of the better people in town.
When you say run the Second City auditions, yeah, that's something you've done for years.
Yeah, like over 20 years.
What is that? That's essentially when people want to get on the touring company.
Yeah.
They go on stage at Second City in front of you and a select few,
yeah,
to essentially improvise a scene.
That's right. Well, they'll improvise some very short scenes and then improvise a longer scene. And then, yeah, I think that's just about it. And then hopefully if they'll get called back. And then if they get called back, then they have to create a one-minute piece and do some scenes, some archive scenes for Second City, and improvise again. Then if they're lucky, they might get placed as an understudy in a touring company.
For you, being at the center of that, I mean, when I remember doing it, it was you were the one who talked.
Uh-huh.
You're the one who said, hey, RK, here's what we're going to do. What does that mean for you? I mean, to know that all these people are outside getting ready, you know, this is the moment where they think they may, you know, make that step in their career, and they come in and you're at the helm.
Yeah, I can tell you that I remember when I first taught at Second City, taught my first class there, and I was 24 years old. And I remember getting off the Sedgwick L, and I remember sitting on a stoop, and I remember starting to cry because I was so scared. I was so nervous. And then I got my, you know, self together, and I walked in and taught that class, which, incidentally, Stephen Colbert was in that class, which was, I didn't realize till later. I remember the first time I auditioned. I was terrified and shaking, hyperventilating, and couldn't eat or anything. So every time I run that audition, I remember that. I remember those times when I was just out of my mind scared, because it is one of the scariest things in the world to walk in that room. Mm-hmm. There's 10 to 15 producers in there. You don't know them. You're on stage. You're at Second City with all its reputation, and you're forced to be funny, or you want to be. So I really try to treat people with kindness and make them feel comfortable and try to make them laugh a little bit or whatever. And it's very important to me to do that.
You mentioned that Second City reputation. For you, you're a big part of that. I mean, the idea of over the years, the shows that you've directed, but also you've been in that building, you do the auditions. And you think of Second City's place in Chicago as you know, people know Second City, it's synonymous with Chicago. What does it mean to you to be synonymous with Chicago?
It's quite okay. It really is. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel good to have that affiliation. And it also makes me feel good to have that relationship with Second City. When Second City caught on fire, I got on my bike and flew down there because I was amazed at how emotional I was about that and what it meant to me. And I think Chicago means more to me now than it ever has. Jennifer and I did an inordinate amount of bike riding this summer, and it was so beautiful to see Chicago from different angles, from the south side, from the west side, and did the 606 like 20 times. I don't know. I really like Chicago. Very accessible, and there's, you know, so enough to do for sure.
Now, I mean, you're in a business where tomorrow they could say, Mick, we want you to be the new director of the new show 3.5 Men that's going to be on CBS. I know.
Yeah.
You're big into that. I mean, is that the work can take you elsewhere?
Yeah.
And it can put you in a different place. You know, you can always come back, but it may take you somewhere else. Are you okay with that?
I am okay with that. I was bizarrely became the executive producer of an NBC sketch pilot last year. So I spent a lot of time in LA. I was very sad when it didn't get picked up in a way, because it was funny because I lost $250,000 because that's what I would have earned if it would have got picked up.
Right, yeah.
So that was kind of fun. But I was also relieved to get back to Chicago. And when I was in New York for 3 years, I was relieved to get back to Chicago as well. I don't know. I always like it here, and I'm really happy the Annoyance is here.
Mick Napier, author, improviser, director, performer. The new book is out this month.
I think so, yeah,
yep.
Later this month.
Also, the reissue's out. I mean, you've got so many things. You can see the shows, Trigger Happy's on Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock. There's so many things happening. Mick, thanks for coming down.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for being here. And congrats on being synonymous with Chicago.
Thank you.
There you go. That was the shortest hip-hop parade of all time there, Zim. I was in my head. I said, like, yeah. Give me a little bit more of my headphones. And I was going to start improv. I was going to freestyle some raps, but then it went away. So, real barn burner in where are they playing? In Dallas or Washington?
Washington, it looks like.
Oh, God. How about it, man? Last week, it was the Ravens and the Browns, which ended up being very exciting because the blocked field goal to win it. But, man, they're really striking out on these Monday Night Football games.
I saw there's a possibility that the Bears may have been flexed to a Sunday night game had they won.
For the Vikings? Or
for the Vikings game, yeah. And the Vikings got killed too, but.
Yeah, that's not going to be a game. I just, even if the Bears win that game, I'm not a big fan of the Vikings. I think that they did exactly what Seattle did, is they're like, take Adrian Peterson out of the game, make the other players play, and they don't have the talent. That's what's going to happen.
No, you're no Stephon Diggs fan or whatever that guy's name is?
No, I'm not. And, you know, he scored the touchdown against the Bears to beat the Bears on a fluke, like, in route that, or like a curl route that someone fell down on. So, whatever. I also think, like, it's just going to end up being the same teams. Think about it. I mean, at the end, we were middle of the season, the NFL, we're like, oh, it's going to be interesting. But the Falcons have fallen away. Maybe Lovey's around a little bit, but it's going to be the Packers and the Seahawks. The Vikings, who were in the playoffs last year, I believe, or the Lions were. One of those two crappy NFC North. Who cares? It'll probably be the Eagles, you know, or one of those Giants, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they could be a 7-9 playoff team.
And then you're going to have the Seahawks and the Cardinals. That's exactly the NFC how it was. We'll talk about this. Talk about the Bears coming up at 10:30. My observations from yesterday's game. Although, I can't stand those jerseys. Maybe we start there. I don't know why they keep trotting those out. Are people buying those? They must have, like, spreadsheets that they go, oh, I don't know, a 13% increase in generic crappy blue and orange jersey that nobody knows means Bears when they wear it.
Yeah, and the helmet with no C on it.
And they do it. I mean, I'm thinking back to the days when I think there was some sort of, you know, return to some Brett Favre thing during the Lovey, it was Dick Geron or Lovey Smith, and it was raining. It was a Monday night, and
it was like Butkus.
Yes, and it was Butkus and the return of Soldier Field, and they were wearing those jerseys. So that's 2003 that they wore those jerseys. So they wear them every year. They've been wearing them for 12 years now. That's bogus. Like, at a certain point, give it up. Like, I'm okay with throwbacks, but there are no other throwbacks besides that one and the one the Bears have now. Go white pants, white jersey. Remember those, like, in the 70s?
Yeah.
All right, we're giving away our 10:30 rant.
Oh, yeah, that's an awesome one. Throwback
to that. The Rams yesterday had their sort of, like, old school, you know, blue and
Vince Ferragamo.
Yeah. But I'd like to see the Bears go white. White pants, white jersey. That's next road game. I think they're on the road next week against Washington. Fly those Bob Avellini style.
Yeah.
Vince Evans style.
All white. Yeah, I like that.
Anyway, coming up 10 o'clock, Michael Shannon. Very excited to talk to him about his return to Chicago Theater. We're going to talk specifically, when putting it together, I could ask him all the questions. He'd be like, what's it like to play General Zod? You're really intense. You're an intense actor. What's it like to almost win an Oscar? You know, and I feel like that's out there enough. But I really want to know about Chicago Theater. So we'll talk to him about why he comes back to do that. You know, he lives in Brooklyn now. He's not even here. But he makes a point to come back and do Chicago Theater. So,
yeah,
and
cool.
He's been a guy who's been a part of that theater scene for a long time. And it's great to see him jump up. And there really is talk about Oscars, the two movies that he's just been in the last couple months. And if he doesn't get it this time, he'll get it next time.
Is it the Oscar talk for the Seth Rogen Christmas movie?
Yes, I think
he's fantastic in that.
Is he in it? Michael Shannon's in it?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that. Let's see. What is he? Is he an evil? Is he evil?
No, he's like a stoner, shocking, in a Seth Rogen movie, but right. like a kind of like a like a not a patriarch, but a a guy that they look up to. They went to high school with him, and he was the drug dealer at the time.
Okay.
You kind of have to see it, all but right. He's really good in it.
Well, I'm not going to see it. I'm not going to see it. So.
Bah humbug.
I forgot. This is part of your holiday thing.
Yeah.
You have to go now. I didn't know you also had to see all the movies that were holiday themed.
I'm not going to go see Krampus.
No, you're going to
Krampus or whatever it is, but
my son is afraid of that. Like it's really well done in terms of the although my son was also afraid of The Purge, Anarchy, which was a weird movie that was, you know, like had a trailer on. It's like one night all criminals get a pass, and then it's just like everyone just kills themselves on. Like it was on.
Oh,
it, was,
yeah.
it was a trailer
oh, yeah.
on.
Yeah,
I'm not saying
that.
He watched
yeah.
it, but I watched it last night because now it's on cable, and I'm like, it's been a year or whatever, and I'm like, oh god, this all right. This is really dumb. I was gonna go wake up. I want to show you what you were scared of. It's not scary. It's trite. It's cliche.
Is that rated R?
It's rated. It has to be. There's so much machine gun in it. That it should be rated R just for the machine gun. Everybody has a machine gun, and the sound. I mean, it's like you're constantly like adjusting your volume because it'll be dialogue.
Oh
be
yeah,
like,
I hate that.
We just gotta keep ourselves together. Watch out! For like 10 minutes, and then you like turn it down a little bit, and then you're I missed the brooding dialogue. We're gonna get out of this together. Then you turn it back up, and you're like, watch out around the corner! It's the worst. And the Oscar for sound design goes to The Purge. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Hood Internet. I'm so excited. Steve Sleeves here. I've been trying to put this together for a while. They're in town for a show on Thursday. One of my favorite DJ collectives in the country, worldwide. We're going to talk with Hood Internet coming up next on The Download. Stay with us. Go. That's what I'm talking about. Hood Internet. Woo! Mixing a little weekend there. One of my favorite DJ collectives working today back in Chicago, talking about the hit duo Hood Internet. They've been at the forefront of, I guess, called the mashup movement. You know, early 2000s and today. They've been seen all over the world playing festivals and clubs. The mashups, in this case, are usually unique. Taking the best of hip-hop and mixing it with indie rock. That's kind of your go-to, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not limited to just that.
But, yeah, but that's kind of like it's always been the fun part.
That's what
our
Wikipedia page says.
So there you go. Yeah. Me, Wikipedia and I are on the same. I feel it. It's a generic masses. Slew of mixtapes, the Hood Internet Volume 1 through 9. The first was put out in 2007, and number 9 just this past fall. They're playing this Thursday night for a show called Kegs for a Cause, a holiday party and charity event at 8:33 at East Room in Logan Square. Hood Internet is ABX and Steve Sleeve. And Steve Sleeve is here with me tonight.
It's me. I'm here. I've never been in WGN
you
radio
haven't,
before.
Really?
It's a nice view.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Well, it's great to have you here. And like I said, I'm a big fan. And we've performed together in shows before. And it was the highlight of my career to be on the same bill with Hood Internet. So that's awesome.
Yeah, at the Hideout, man.
Yeah. So let's talk about you guys. Because I do say the you know, kind of the evolution of the mashup. I mean, when you guys first started, was that the concept of taking two different songs and putting them together in sort of a remix version?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Hood Internet started, we didn't necessarily start as DJs. We sort of started in 2007 as a music blog, an MP3 blog, which were, you know, really just burning up the internet at the moment, you know. The concept, you know, mashup had been, that sort of concept had been around
right.
for much, much longer, you know, like... As early as, I mean, one of the earliest examples is like the DJ Steinsky was making mixes like that, you know, just sort of like taking things that were not necessarily supposed to go together and finding them, you know, like either via like remaking the music or repitching the music or whatever, just kind of getting them in a different context.
Right. And you guys, as a blog, as a music blog, it's great music, but there also was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek humor to it, that the idea that taking a hip-hop track and taking an indie rock track that might be fun together, putting it together and entertaining that way. But at some point or another, I mean, when you guys started doing the mixtapes and everything, I mean, it came together, as we just heard with that Weekend track. I mean, it's straight up remix. I mean, it's got a sound and a vibe, and you guys are much more than just bloggers on the internet at this point.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the idea of a mashup, I mean, not long after we had started, like, people were sort of already tired of how much it had proliferated itself on the internet, which, you know, there's a lot of them out there. But, you know, to me there was always like, where's the line between this is a mashup, you know, of just like A and B, versus like this is a remix that samples this mm-hmm. other thing, you know? And sometimes it's a question of whether or not like additional production comes into play. And you know, ABX and I come from a background of, you know, we met playing in a band together and had played in bands for years, and just, you know, kind of had this like musical background that I think we had a good understanding of things like cadence and pitch and tempo. So that piecing this stuff together wasn't just like carelessly trying to slap A with B. It was like, oh, do you hear this? This kind of has a similar like rhythmic structure to this. Let's give it a try and see if it works. And there is a lot of trial and error in what we do. Mostly error, I guess.
I doubt that. But I mean, for you guys, is there, I mean, when you hear a song, I mean, with your musical background, and you hear a song like the Weekend song we just heard, I Can't Feel My Face, do you automatically go, I know what I'm going to put that with? Like, when you hear it, you're like, oh, that sounds just like... I mean, how do you sort of figure out what to mash what up with?
Only sometimes. I mean, there's... Sometimes a melodic passage will remind you of something from another song. Or, you know, you just get a notion that, you know, X might fit with Y. And you sit down and you try it. And sometimes, if you, like, really... If you're like, oh, this would totally work. Half the time... you know, the feeling is right. But then sometimes you sit down, and this is what I mean about the error, and you're like, oh, it just doesn't work at all. And I think in our earlier days, we would post so much. We would post like one of these a day on the website, which was just like, you know, some of them were like real bad.
Like, well, there were more error that way.
There was just some that we were forcing, I think, to like, you know, to keep posting on the website. And then as the years went by, you know, we really started to filter that out, as well as tried to construct stuff, you know, not entirely, but largely for that would work on the dance floor, because the DJing stuff kind of came in later.
Well, I want to ask all about that, and we'll do that after the news, as we're getting close to a break here. But the for you guys, knowing what you said about the mashup world, where you were at when you guys started 2007, there probably was 7 years or so, or 5 years of mashups just making it to the mainstream. What was it about you guys that kept you wanted to keep doing it, even though you kind of felt that maybe it was, you know, the internet was getting sick of it?
Well, I mean, the internet is sick of everything, like at all times. But, you know, for us, it was like, it was our music blog. Like, this was our, you know, our curation. Like, we were picking the songs that we were sampling. And because of that huge Girl Talk record that came out the year before, Night Ripper, which is a great record, I think people's ears were really open to hearing this stuff. And, you know, people will be like, you know, either just like, well, mashups are trash altogether, or they'll be like, well, you know, but these guys at least
are there
okay
people that
it.
Say that? They say mashups are trash?
Oh, yeah, of course.
They just don't like the idea that someone has like scientifically, genetically engineered two songs and make one?
I love it. I love it too. And obviously we've been doing it for, for 9 years now. But I think people find that there's like, and you know, I could see this. Some people think that there is a lack of creativity behind it, which I think is a sort of a subjective idea, because there are plenty out there, like I said, that sort of just like carelessly, you know, cobble something together and you're like, well, you know, here it is, print it up. And it can feel a little empty, but I think, you know, with us, like I talk about, it's a music blog and it comes from music. You know, we sample what we love and we put together these tapes and go out and DJ shows because it is a blast. We listen to music we like, and, you know, our fans continue to be into what we do.
But what I don't understand about it, and this is just my editorial on it, is you're not saying, I created this great new piece of music. Listen to this voice track I recorded. I can't feel my... You know, like we no, understand
that
it.
That is me singing.
Yeah, that is you, yeah. We understand the concepts of it. Nobody is suggesting that, you know, you're stealing or ripping off somebody else's idea. It's creative that you took two ideas like an artist does.
Sure.
And put them together. To me,
it's always been a little more transparent way of citing the source. You know, back in the days, like DJs that had like secret weapons for samples, you know, that you would keep that on the low. But nowadays, like, you know, have you ever used that website, Who Sampled?
Yeah.
Just a wonderful archive.
You're
like,
out.
What
yeah.
is that from this song? And it shows the source. And, you know, we've always been like pretty transparent about like having them in the file name. There was this person on Twitter that was like, how much longer are the Hood Internet going to get away with like putting their own name in the artist tag of the ID3 info of the MP3? I was like, dude, that is a super specific thing to be mad about.
There's protests. How dare you? How dare you put that in the SEO? Yeah. Steve Sleeve, Hood Internet, they're in town. Thursday night, Kegs for a Cause, a holiday party at the East Room in Logan Square. Let's take a break. We come back. We'll talk more about Hood Internet mashups and hitting the dance floor. Stay with us.
Lost, take a walk to the lake to ease my mind and I wander off, trying to get up in my own zone. No, I don't really want to talk. Lay back in the grass looking up at marshmallow clouds and the sunshine loud, but a tree gives shade and I'm way too high. Want to thank this day, want to make that point that it could have been great.
Oh, that's could've great, man. Prob Cause, Chance the Rapper coming up, Hood Internet remix. Here on the download on WGN, Hood Internet, Steve Sleeve in studio with me tonight. I'm a big fan of your work. I said this earlier in the show that when I get to a certain point where I'm like, okay, I got 20 minutes. This used to be at another shop where I'd work, and I'd be like on news desk. And they're like, you got 10 minutes to get this story, Kaufman. And I'd be like, bam, put the headphones on and be like, mixtape 4, maybe mixtape 6, Hood Internet. And I'm like, don't talk to me. And I would write the whole scripts and news with you guys in my headphones.
That's great. And none of the lyrics, like, you know, like accidentally filtered in just... You know,
I'm like, there. Get up, get on up, get on up. The news today.
Yeah, they're like, this isn't really, well, okay.
We're talking with Hood Internet, Steve Sleeve here. They're going to be in town this Thursday night, Kegs for a Cause at the East Room in Logan Square. Also starting up a tour, which is the smartest thing ever to start in January. Where are you going?
It's just, we'll be touring throughout a lot of 2016, but January, February mm-hmm. is West Coast. Up just from the top to the bottom, all the way from Bellingham, Washington to Tijuana.
And see, the perfect thing. You're such a Chicagoan that you know to avoid the Midwest. Let me ask you this, though. When I say Hood Internet is touring, what can we expect from those shows? I mean, what kind of venues do you play?
You know, it's great that you and I played a place like The Hideout together at a show in the past because that, you know, we often get sort of lumped in with the current wave of electronic music and the kind of clubs that surround that. But we are more the type to play rock venues, you know, like the Hideout or like the Metro or, you know, on the West Coast, it's like that. It's like kind of mid-sized rock clubs. The Crocodile in Seattle.
Yeah.
Mississippi Studios in Portland. The only real outlier there is that we're going to be at the Natural History Museum in L.A.
Sure.
Not as an exhibit. We will be performing.
It's like one of their like Friday night single mixers.
They're like, why are we in a glass box? This is so weird.
They're like mashups. Yeah, behind yep. the yeah. Let me ask you, so the idea, and I've seen you perform. So when you get up on stage, it's you and ABX, and your computers are up, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically so where the music's coming from.
For a lot of people who may not go to an EDM show or a DJ show, I mean. The idea, there's not a huge, you're not you know, flashing lights and, you know, shooting off T-shirt cannons.
Sometimes we
sometimes
flash lights.
Yeah, but most of it is just like, this is where the music comes from. We plug into their system and, you know, dance.
You know, we use some software. I mean, there is a few more like kind of pieces of hardware on stage. We'll use like a traditional DJ mixer so we can sort of cue up the next thing we're listening to and, you know, blah blah blah. But we're not like using turntables or CDJs or things like that. I don't know what other things there are. Dual 8-track players.
Yeah, right.
But we do. It's interesting you mentioned the thing about lights, because we do. It's very DIY, but our friend Morgan, who was the lighting director at Metro, and now he works with a bunch of bands like Band of Horses, he built us a custom set of LED lights.
Oh, wow.
And what's cool about the DJ software that we use, Ableton Live, is it can also kind of send information out to like have the lights play along in time with the music.
Right.
We have to program all that.
But you can hit it to the beats, like something's coming up, bam!
Yeah, I did a tour a couple of years ago where it was just that there was no lighting director with us. It was just the computer kind of telling everything what to do, which is, you know, it's modern technology.
So let's talk about, you know, your relationship with your audience, because over the years, I mean, I'm sure when you first started, you said you were musicians, you played on stage before, but this is a different kind of thing. I mean, there's a little bit of like, you got your headphones on and maybe you're going to press a button and move some stuff around, but it's not as interactive as a band and an audience.
Yeah, we're not ripping guitar solos. Maybe, like, definitely some air guitar solos at certain points in songs. But it is very different. You know, that was when we got into it. Like I mentioned earlier, the DJing aspect of this didn't really come along until a couple months into what we were doing. Jim at Chicagoist had asked us to come and play their anniversary show, and we're like, okay, but we don't know what we're doing. which seemed to be of no concern. So after that train wreck of a show, we kind of realized we needed to come up with a better
system.
Why was it
a train wreck?
We had just finished mixtape one, and we played that, and we pretended to put records inside of our laptops, so it was more of a performance art piece. but after that, we got more shows and a booking agent, so we kind of, you know, learned, we figured we had to do better than that if we wanted to continue doing it.
I went and saw an EDM show not too long ago in Logan Square, and it's the first time I'd seen it, and it was a whole thing around one guy who had turntable or his computer set up, but it was just like there was hundreds of people in the room. This one guy who was like, like, and everyone was, but at the end of the day, no one really cared about that guy. Meaning everyone, like, you look to the left, you look to the right, they were jiving, they were into the music. They had their heads down talking to their friends, but the music was definitely a background, even though this is who they came to see.
Sure.
So for you guys, I mean, how is it like that, knowing that a lot of what you're doing, you know, is background music to people who might want to talk, who might want to be. So it's not as visceral as like, I need to watch what Steve Sleeve is doing.
To me, it's better when people are not watching us, because the, you know, what we're doing, the purpose of what we're doing is to like go out and play these kind of, you know, mixes that we created under our, you know, creative duo. And we kind of pick the best of that for the dance floor. And then we want people to dance. I mean, if they look at us, it's not going to be like, I start dancing because I'm having fun, but you know, I don't think people need to be watching that for too long. Like, I think it's good, you know, the concept of electronic music. And I to what you said, like, I think people do, I know what you mean, but I think people do like care about those artists. They have the identities, they know like their songs. So many of those, you know, the big EDM artists are playing so much of each other's music, which is, you know, and there's so many like remixes of each other's music, and there's, it is, I mean, it's bizarre.
It's a whole thing, man.
It's bizarre. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, like back, it's like Bruce Springsteen writing a song for Manfred Mann. people used to write songs for each other.
It's very 70s
It's the exact same thing as that. There's no differences.
Steve Sleeve, Hood Internet. Let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk more. You guys are playing Thursday night, Kegs for a Cause, at the East Room in Logan Square. More with Steve, and we come back here on The Download. Stay with us.
Number 9.
God, I love this right here.
Number 9.
This is so good.
Number 9.
Shorty get down, good lord. Baby got him open all over town. Strictly bitch, you don't play around. Cover much grounds, got game by the pound. Getting paid is
than I am on top of it. So that's the third. Is that we're doing that now?
Steve Flint.
Just letting you do your thing, man. We knew we were going to use that Beatles sample.
Oh, that's so good.
That's great. Steve Sleeve, Hood Internet in studio with me. They got a show on Thursday night. What we were just listening to right there was the new Hood Internet Volume 9, Hood Internet Mixtape Volume 9, which was put out this past fall in October. Steve, Chicagoan, is here in town before they split for another tour. You know, it's interesting because we were just talking off air about the popularity of DJs in pop music right now, because you're seeing a lot of Skrillex, Diplo is comes to mind, but a lot of DJs and DJ collectives that are becoming the go-to producers for the pop music that people are listening to in top 40.
I mean, that stuff's been dominating the clubs for so long, it seems almost like completely logical that pop music would just sort of like gravitate towards making that kind of music. I mean, like, have you heard the new Madonna song?
I haven't, no.
It's,
is it all club?
It's, yeah, I mean, it's like, it's pretty clubby. And like, she played the Ultra Music Festival a couple years ago. Like, and I'm using Madonna as an example of like how much, like, you know, pop music gravitates towards that when it's hot.
Yeah. That, I mean, look at the stars right now that are the pop music quintessential stars. I mean, Justin Bieber comes to mind, Selena Gomez, even in the last couple of years, Britney Spears. They've all gravitated towards a more electronic sound than the sort of, you know, four chord pop song used to be.
And, you know, I think these producers that come from the DJ world could make those four chord pop songs too, and they could make them better because they have a better command of, you know, like sound and production. Just because of time, like not to say that they are any better than their predecessors, but they, you know, technology has changed the way sound comes out of speakers. You know, like what you can access with home production software is infinite.
And you're suggesting that the DJs of today are now skilled in it. They've become those. They know all the things, the tricks they can do to make the music even better.
Yeah, you know, I think when, you know, and a cool like kind of sub angle of all this is that. That, you know, that trickles down to where a lot of like modern pop stars, you know, rap, R&B, hip hop, whatever, are using more unique producers like Jeremih from Chicago.
Yeah.
He worked a lot with like Shlomo and the We Did It Collective, and that, you know, they made some really, really cool like future sounding stuff.
You know, it's interesting too because it's amazing to think of all the collectives and the DJ the duos and the people who are involved in behind the music. You know, when you think of just one song that comes out,
sure.
I think you posted about the Grammy nomination of Kanye West All Day.
Oh yeah,
and there's like
21 writers.
21 writers.
I mean, but that's like you get a bunch of people in a room, you're working on a little part, you get writing credit.
Do you guys, you and ABX, see yourself making a transition at some point? I mean, you do mostly mashups, but you have done your own remixes. You've worked in that vibe. Is that kind of the future of what you see you as a musician working on producing and remixing in that arena?
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be more of that in our future. You know, we've done a fair amount of it so far, and you know, we've been musicians our whole lives. I can't imagine it ever stopping. But we've produced a few songs this year with, you know, like other vocalists or, you know, we put out a record in 2012 that was all kind of collaborations with different musicians. It was pretty like all over the map in terms of the styles we made. But, you know, the point of it was we were like, what would a Hood Internet record sound like if it wasn't a bunch of mashups?
What would it sound like? I mean, if you had to do it another one today, I mean, what's your sound if it's not the mashup?
I don't know that I'd be able to nail it down other than using a super wide umbrella like pop music. And, you know, that can mean a lot of things. But I've always thought that that's been our approach.
See, when you think about DJing, and we talked about our show we did at the Hideout a couple of years back. How has Chicago been as a market for your kind of music, for doing clubs, for performing? Is Chicago as open of a market as, say, I don't know, New York for dance music?
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, Chicago in terms of, like, I mean, in terms of dance and electronic music, you got the history of house music, you know. So there's, like, you know, and that's very different than what we do, obviously. And but that's, there's a huge history for that here. You know, places like Smart Bar that have been around since 82. Places like, you know, there's a lot of clubs nowadays. There's, what's the name of the place downtown? Primary. There's, now I'm blanking.
No, but there's,
now I'm blanking
because
I don't
right?
have all the facts in front of me. But there's a pretty wide range of electronic music clubs here. And I think shows that come through.
What I have, I've I don't always know. Had a problem with, and I just don't know it as a consumer, is I'll go into one of these clubs, right? A bottle service type club on a Friday night, and I just end up there, you know, because I roll.
Yeah.
And
you do?
Yeah, of course.
I heard some laughter from the production booth there.
No, but when you go in, I can't tell if that's the house guy who put on Pandora, or if it's an actual DJ who's got name recognition. Like, it's really hard to, like, tell, like, especially, like, in the landscape that it's Hubbard Street in Chicago.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're not, like, an active consumer of that stuff, it may not sound different to you. But, you know, like, these DJs and, like, some of these guys that rule the club circuit downtown, like Phenom or Zeebo, like, those guys, you know their stuff. You know when they're playing, if, like, you're coming to see them play at, like, the Mid or wherever you go. But sometimes you walk into, like, a restaurant and you're, you know, it could be a restaurant or just some small club, and it's exactly like what you're saying here. Like, there could be a DJ. You might not see them. They might be tucked in the corner, or it might be a Pandora playlist, or it might be, like, somebody's SoundCloud.
Right.
I think that all comes back to, like, what you were saying about, you know, the people not putting so much more importance on the DJ on stage, and then more so just the, you know, the atmosphere of the room. What matters to people at the end of it is what is coming out of the speakers and if they like it or not, and if it makes them want to dance.
There you go. Steve Sleeve, Hood Internet, the mixtape volume 9 is out. You can also check them out Thursday night, Kegs for a Cause, at the East Room in Logan Square. Hood Internet is ABX, and of course Steve Sleeve. Steve, thanks for stopping by. Good luck with the tour.
Thanks.
And so smart to do West Coast in January.
Man, I'm saying.
You're learning, man. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, Michael Shannon is back home in Chicago, starring on stage at the Red Orchid in Pilgrim's Progress. Shannon, of course, is a longtime Chicago theater star who now entertains the masses on television, had the star turn in Boardwalk Empire, and, of course, on the silver screen. He got an Oscar nom for Revolutionary Road. He played General Zod in Man of Steel and the upcoming Batman vs. Superman. And one of his latest, which is getting rave reviews, 99 Homes. And Lookout World 2016 looks to be a banner year for Michael Shannon. Mr. Shannon, welcome to The Download.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're back in town for your own theater, Red Orchid, which is great. How's it feel to be back here in Chicago doing theater at this time of year?
You know, it's such a great feeling. It's this really feels like home to me, you know, particularly this theater. I've been with Red Orchid ever since it opened, and we're close to 23 years now in business, and it just really means a lot to me. There's a lot of history in this room for me. There's a lot of ghosts. And a lot of the work I've done that I care the most about, I've done in this room, including the play that I'm doing right now. So it's pretty special.
It's amazing. 23 years for any theater company, whether it's a big theater company, small theater company, down in the loop or off loop. What's the secret to Red Orchid's success to be around for that long?
Oh, geez. Well, it takes a lot of daring do, I guess. I mean, honestly, there have been points in time where it seemed like the whole thing was going to crumble. We've had dark patches where the theater's kind of been off the grid for a few months at a time. You know, when we originally opened, we didn't have a subscription season, or we didn't even have that kind of ambition. We just kind of did a play whenever we felt like doing a play. And so if we didn't feel like doing anything, we would just lock the door and disappear for a little while, which is pretty unusual. But now we tried to grow up, you know, and now we have a subscription season. We try to at least do 3 plays a year, sometimes more. But I think, I think it's really about passion, you know. It's about the desire to do it. I think what dissipates for a lot of people is the desire, because that's the engine of the whole thing. There's no money. There's no glamour. There's no, you're not going to get famous, you know. Doing off-loop theater, you really just have to keep showing up because you can't imagine your life without it.
Well, this has got to be hard for you, you know, as your schedule continues to get stronger and more clamoring for Michael Shannon to be in movies here and there. Is it harder to get back to the theater, to get back to the off-loop theater, to make time in your schedule to do shows like you're doing now?
Well, we had to come up with a pretty complicated schedule in order to make this happen for Pilgrim's Progress, because in the month of October, running up to our opening, I went and shot a movie in L.A., and I would go there for 3 or 4 days at a time, then come back, rehearse for a couple of days, and go away again, back and forth. We started rehearsing in August just to give ourselves enough time. You know, this is a world premiere, and we knew that we'd want to spend time with the script and really make sure we got it right. But, you know, even in August and September, I was having to take little trips here and there to promote 99 Homes or go to festivals or things like that. So it's, you know, it's very different than the typical, you know, 4 weeks of rehearsal and you open. But honestly, as convoluted as I thought it was, everybody involved with the process seemed to really enjoy having the opportunity to walk away from it for a few days. They felt like it gave them the time to really to sit with the material and kind of meditate and contemplate on it. And honestly, it seemed like people were pretty happy to work in this very unusual way.
You know, you live in Brooklyn now. You come back to Chicago for shows like this, but you spent a number of years in Chicago theater. You just mentioned it with Red Orchard, 23 years. Take us back to when you first came here and to do theater, you know, after college, and you said, okay, I'm going to do some storefront stuff. What was the scene like here? What do you remember most about Chicago's off-loop theater scene?
Well, honestly, it wasn't even college. It was high school. I actually, it's funny, I was at Evanston Township High School. It was my senior year, and I had just done the school production of Taming of the Shrew. I played Baptiste Manola. Anyway, I found out about this newspaper called Perform, Inc. Yeah. Like performing, but with a K at the end instead of a G. And I found this newspaper, I think probably at Scenes, that coffee shop that used to be on Clark Street, where they sold plays and, you know, that actors mingled and whatever. So I found this newspaper, and I found the auditions in the back, and I auditioned for a play, and I got the part, and I said, to hell with high school, I'd rather go do this. So I just started doing it. This is when I was 16 years old. The first thing I did was a play called Winter Set by Maxwell Anderson. It's written in blank verse, a beautiful play about... It's a hypothetical play about if the sun, you know, Sacco and Vanzetti, the Italian anarchists that were executed in the 20s or so. It imagines if one of their sons was trying to seek revenge for the father, you know. It was very beautiful. So anyway, I did that, and that was out in the burbs. Illinois Theater Center was out in, like, Park Forest or Forest Park or River Park Forest or one of those places, you know.
Right.
But then the second show I did, which was incredibly meaningful to me, was these 2 one-act plays by Howard Korder, who ironically was one of the main writers on Boardwalk Empire all these years later. The plays were called Fun and Nobody. And the first one, Fun, was about 2 teenagers skipping school and getting into trouble. And the second one, Nobody, was about the father of one of these kids getting laid off from his job and kind of losing his marbles. So the guy who played my father, I was in Fun, you know, I played the punk kid. And then the guy who played my father was a guy, Tracy Letts, who obviously wound up
having
a huge impact on my life. And it was funny because he was playing my dad, but he was only 25 at the time, so he was only 9 years older than me. But Tracy's just kind of always looked like he could be your dad, you know, ever since he was 25. And Dexter Buller directed that production. Yeah. Dexter's somebody I've worked with God knows how many times over the years. Fantastic director. And that, I'd say that production was really my introduction to the scene here, meeting Tracy, meeting a lot of other great actors. At the time, the show right before Fun and Nobody was a show called Bouncers that had been a huge, huge hit. It had been running for months, and it was about these bouncers at this British nightclub. And it was just the bee's knees at the time. Everybody was saying, you know, it's the best thing going. So I saw that, and I couldn't believe that I was going to be working in the same theater as those guys. And shortly after Fun and Nobody, I saw a show in there starring Stephen Colbert, because Dexter put together a play. I don't know if Dexter wrote it or what, but Stephen Colbert at the time was very much a part of this Chicago theater.
Yeah, of course.
Working at Second City, and so I saw Stephen Colbert do a play.
Let me ask you this, Michael, because you know you mentioned the names, even Tracy Letts, Stephen Colbert, Dexter Bullard. These are names that you're, you know, in your career you performed with and worked and collaborated with again. How important is it as you moved up and saw more opportunities in film and television? How important were those connections, those Chicago relationships that you forged when you began in theater?
Well, you know, I mean, Tracy will debate this with me, or he'll say I'm giving him too much credit. But as far as I'm concerned, if I hadn't met Tracy, because Tracy obviously started writing plays. He wrote a play called Killer Joe, mm-hmm. and Killer Joe completely changed my life. I was in the original cast of Killer Joe. We did it at Next Lab for like 8 months. Then we went to Edinburgh Festival, the Fringe. Then we went to London. Then next thing I know, I was on the West End. I was on the West End in London. Here I am, some, you know, 19-year-old punk, doesn't know his ass from his elbow. And I'm on the West End in London at this beautiful old theater, the Vaudeville Theater, 800 seats. And that was Tracy. I mean, you know, if I had been doing equally, you know, whatever, impressive work in a play that, like, you know, The Glass Menagerie or something, it would have never gone to all those places,
right.
You know. Killer Joe was an incredibly exciting play to be a part of, and it was a world premiere, and nobody had ever seen anything like it before. Now, I'm not saying I didn't work my butt off. I did. I worked very hard. I did the play. I did 400 performances of that play. But, you know, without Killer Joe, Killer Joe is what brought me to the UK. It's what brought me to New York. And when I was in New York, I met a manager who took me to Hollywood, and the rest is history. You know, and then Bug, you know, he wrote Bug,
yep.
And same thing there. You know, these are two roles, Chris Smith and Peter Evans, that kind of define, as far as I'm concerned, define my career. I mean, Bug, I eventually got to make the movie out of it. So, you know, and then yeah, with Dexter, you know, Dexter hasn't made a foray in the film, but every step of the way, you know, the meaningful productions I've done, particularly in New York, you know, whether it's Bug or Mistakes Are Made or my first show on Broadway, Grace, you know, Dexter was a part of that. So, yeah, they've remained very important.
Well, you've mentioned, you know, a couple towns with great theater communities, London, New York. What is the difference? What differentiates Chicago from those places as a theater community? What makes Chicago better or worse than, say, a London or a New York community?
I hate to make huge generalizations about the things like that, but I think there's an ethic here that transcends, like, money or ambition or fame or any of these things. You know, when you take a place like Red Orchid, you're talking about people that are so devoted to the art that they're willing to take huge risks, and they're not necessarily worried about making people happy in the audience or, you know, selling out the show or, you know, all those things are always appreciated. You can never get away from that, but it's not the primary objective. It's the primary objective is to push yourself further than you went the last time, or to go somewhere that you haven't gone before, or to make a complete ass out of yourself, just, you know, wandering off into some unknown territory that may lead to some sort of revelation.
or some sort of, you know, new form that you had never thought possible. But that's us. That's Red Orchid. You know, there's theaters in Chicago that are very much oriented to or accustomed to trying to please the crowd, please mm-hmm. the audience, you know, offer you a bang-up night out on the town, whatever. And in New York, there's also, you know, there's some incredible experimental theater in New York, too. But my feeling in New York is that it's there's a lot more anxiety about, you know, is this going to work? Are people going to see it? You know, because it's more expensive.
Right. That's more commerce-driven, sort of right.
Yeah, yeah, unless you're really, really off Broadway. But even off-Broadway theater is incredibly expensive and can be a real, you know, people have really lost a bundle doing stuff off-Broadway. So you got to be, it's just more concern, you know. In terms of London, I mean, it's really hard to shake a stick in London. I mean, it's kind of It's kind of the epicenter of the whole thing, you know.
I mean,
the stuff I got to do over there, I still think about it to this day and get very nostalgic about the opportunities I had there. And I would love to go back, but it's hard now that I have two kids because I don't like to be away from them too much.
Well, let me ask you this as we wrap up. Let me ask you, you know, as you get into the rhythm of doing a show at Red Orchid, when you get into the rhythm of being back on stage in Chicago, what's the routine? What are you most looking forward to? Are you looking forward to the actual work, the camaraderie, the after party? What is it about getting back on stage at Red Orchid that has gotten you excited?
Well, it starts with the room for me, the room itself. Being in that room, inevitably every night that I'm out there on stage, or you know, afternoon in the case of a matinee, there's a moment where I think this is such an incredible room. Particularly, you know, when you have the good fortune of having a full house, and you look around, you think about all these people crammed into this little room, and they're all having a different experience. And yet they're all kind of having the same experience. They're all watching the same thing, and yet there's something entirely different going through each one of their minds. And then there's us on the stage, you know. And it's inevitably kind of hallucinogenic, you know. It's like tripping, you know. And, you know, with the play I'm doing here, it's a play about family, and it feels like a family, you know. The four of us feel like a family, and it's a feeling that you don't get a lot of times if you're doing like a movie or the TV show or whatever. That bond isn't really, it doesn't get as thick, you know, or as strong, because you don't get the time to really, you know, like I said, we've been working on this since August, and we're going to keep doing it till the middle of December.
Yeah.
And it's just extraordinary to get to spend that much time with a piece of writing and a group of people. It's really thrilling to see all the different directions that it goes in. You know?
Well, the show is Pilgrim's Progress. It's running till mid-December at the Red Orchid in Old Town. Michael Shannon, back home here in Chicago. Michael, thanks for taking some time out to talk to us about it.
No problem. Thanks, Justin. They're the monsters of the Midway. The monsters have come to play.
Cowboys and Redskins go running. Lions are lying on the ground. That's a good tune, man. That's like, I feel like that's one from the 85 team. Was it like a goofy kind of 86, 87? Like capitalization off Super Bowl Shuffle? Maybe it's like the, like made by the Channel 2 team, like for the recap of the 87 season.
Give Pete a gold star for the night on that one.
I love that. I feel like I remember that as a kid. Like, I feel like Monsters of the Midway. Like we joked about, maybe got that CD or that cassette tape from the Solozzi Edelson Chevrolet at the time.
Where you always save more money.
Yeah, when you come in and you want to get a Chevy Malibu, we'll give you this cassette of a great new song, Monsters of the Midway.
At York tear and Roosevelt Road.
There you go. So where are we at in this game, Rob? This I feel like we've become the epicenter, the place to go for Monday Night Football recap. There's the 20 seconds to play, and it looks like the Cowboys have driven themselves by sheer determination to field goal range, so they can miss it and go to overtime.
You know, they're close. They probably need about 10, 15 more yards.
Oh, well.
And that pass was just batted away.
It's like the worst game. I'm not a big fan of, you know, we were talking about last week, like Monday Night Football has really kind of really taken it on the chin in terms of picking the wrong games. But they're picking division games, right? This is supposed to be something, right?
I mean, yeah, this is a pretty big rivalry, and both teams are in playoff contention. The Cowboys have 3 wins, and the Redskins have 5, I think.
And last week, I guess Ravens and Browns, it used to be
The Cleveland connection, I guess, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, this segment right now, we want to talk about observations from the Chicago Bears game, but not just your who won, who lost kind of stuff. You know, what we want to talk about is what really counts from yesterday's broadcast, as the Chicago Bears lost in overtime to the San Francisco 49ers in a game that drops them to 5-7 and pretty much, even if they run the table, knocks them out of playoff contention, which, as we said at the beginning of the show, thank you for making it this far, because you started 0-3 and we had there were no expectations of this team. I mean, there really weren't. I mean, they finally won a game against, I think it was Oakland. Mm-hmm. We were like, oh, okay, 1-3. That's great. And it wasn't until, but then they have not actually been 500 yet.
Mm-mm.
There it is. And look at that. The Dallas Cowboys just kick a field goal to take the lead here with 9 seconds to play. 19-16. The Dallas Cowboys looking for win number 4 and the first win without Tony Romo.
Mm.
I think he's won all 3 games that he started. But enough about the Cowboys. You watch a game yesterday, Pete?
Heck yeah.
Bears Niners, man, there used to be some great, those are some of the wonderful regular season games. You think about 2 games that come to mind. One was on Monday Night Football in maybe like 87, 88, 89. I have to think. Someone will correct us. Where both teams were pretty much undefeated, if not one loss, and they were the Titans of the Titans of the league. And the Niners came to Soldier Field, and everyone had them pegged. I think it was Steve Young, maybe, or maybe Montana still, as the team to beat the Bears, because the Bears were defense and nothing else. Mm-hmm. I think it was probably already Tom Zach. You know, Tom Zach handing off to Neil Anderson. And the Bears won that game really close, like 10-9. And it was a screen or a swing pass to Roger Craig. And he went, a 4th down and 3. And he was going for the first down. And Dave Duerson just stood him up, knocked him out of bounds. They didn't get the first. It was classic Bears regular season. The other one, which I intended this game, was the game of the Dick Duron days when Mike Brown took it back to the house. That was not good football. That was miraculous football, because that's when the Bears, that whole game, what everyone talks about is the fact that the Bears had this miraculous comeback and won and, you know, pick 6 in overtime. But the whole game, they were terrible. That was I don't even think it was Cade McNown. He might have been the quarterback.
I think Jim Miller.
It might have been Jim Miller. It might have still been Shane Matthews' time. But that game, the best thing that happened at that game was got tickets, was the old Soldier Field. And we sat, it used to be, and I don't know if it's still the same, but there used to be different sides. Like you'd be on the San Francisco side, and that was an easier ticket because it was the visitor side, the home side. Like I think there was more of that tradition before.
Like a high school football game.
Yeah, I think it was more tradition that way before. And this would have been 2001, 2000. So beforehand, we were sitting on the San Francisco side, and two Bears fans, drunk, a little bit older, decided that it would be great to, you know, trash talk.
Heckle.
Yeah. The Niner fans. Like 2 guys had their, like, you know, like coming down with their cheese and their nachos and their Joe Montana jersey. And the guy said something so, you know, you can't even say it. It's like politically incorrect. Like it was something about San Francisco being gay. You know, something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. But he's like, hey, why don't you, clever. Wine and cheese. Yeah, why don't you have your wine and cheese, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you're just like, oh, I'm glad I didn't bring any kids to this game. I'm glad you had to shout that 12 rows, right? I don't know why you had to do that. But then the guy turned around, the Niner guy turned around. He goes, why don't you go work in a factory for minimum wage, huh? Like, that was his shot back to Chicago. I was like, oh, touche. Touche. So that's all I remembered. I was like, oh, well, there you go. I guess we both learned something about stereotypes today.
Yeah, that was an awesome game. Because there were two in a row, like 2 weeks and two weekends in a row. Was that the first one or the second
first
one?
Yeah,
so it was like Cleveland or?
They got a Hail Mary. It was so dumb. But yeah, that team broke our hearts in the way that they went, 13-3 or something, and then went to the playoffs and it was obvious they didn't belong. They were gone.
Donovan McNabb, I think, ran all over him.
I can tell you.
Or was that the Carolina Panthers, Steve Smith?
No, that was during Lovey.
That was 2005.
And that was John Fox, who went to the, if I'm not mistaken, that was the year he went to the Super Bowl, right?
It must have been.
They were always in the playoffs. Anyway. Should we take a break? We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about our observations from yesterday's Niners-Bears game. An overtime nail-biter. That wasn't really a nail-biter.
Soaps, feet are screaming. Everybody's eyes is open wide. Somebody's in for a creaming. And Papa Bear is cheering on the side. They're the monsters.
This is somebody's in for a cleaning? Is that what it was? Cleaning or cleaning?
Creaming.
Oh, creaming. You're in for a cleaning. This Bears are going to clean up this campsite. Great tune, man. All right, so observations from yesterday's loss. I will say that the one positive, and we talked about this as well. We kind of already I gave away my first point. I'm done with those jerseys. I don't remember a Bears team that wears that jersey that does well. I don't have a number 6 Jay Cutler in my head where I'm like, when those are on, he throws for 350. No, usually they wear them when they're in a division game against the Packers and he throws pick sixes. And he did it yesterday. And I feel like if you're going to go, you got to vary up the throwbacks. I know the Bears have had the same jersey for eternity, but you and I just picked we just talked about the away white and white from the 70s.
Or that the Gale Sayers, like that the white C, remember the white C?
Yeah, right. Where are those?
Yeah.
Why do they keep going back to these? And I don't even think there was a Bears team that had these. I think I'll be a conspiracy theorist. I think they're making it up. I think there is no such thing as that. I'd like someone to text me a picture of Dick Butkus wearing that jersey.
A couple of years ago, I went as Jay Cutler for Halloween. I actually went as smoking Jay Cutler for Halloween. And so I had to find a jersey. And I'm like, I don't want to buy a Cutler jersey. You know, that sucks. But you got one of those on sale, you know, cheap. I didn't buy it myself. Somebody else in my family bought it
hilarious.
And then I ended up giving it to a guy who made videos that he burned Jay Cutler jerseys.
Oh, good.
And he made a video that he burned.
So maybe that's the market they're going for. Hi, are you looking for a Halloween costume, or are you participating in the burn the Jay Cutler jersey? Well, we've got a throwback jersey for you. I mean, it's ridiculous. I don't know. I would like to see them go more 7, like the white pants.
I
want to
see the white. White on white.
White on
awesome.
White would be awesome. Whatever. All right, what were your observations from the game?
Well, last week I said that, you know, this team's going to make the playoffs. They're going to run the table. Disappointment. But I didn't watch the game live yesterday. I was working at a craft fair.
As you do.
On the weekends, I do the crafting circuit. And then, as you might expect, at a craft fair, you're not hearing a lot of people talking about football.
Right.
So I was able to avoid the game the whole day. Night, 8 o'clock, I'm driving home, accidentally turn on the radio, boom, the score comes on.
They're like, what a loss.
Right, 26-20 in overtime. So I'm like, oh, crap. So I'm like, well, you know, it's the Bears. I got to watch the Bears. So I'm watching it with knowing that they lost in overtime. But I would say do this. very enjoyable to watch the game.
Knowing the outcome.
In that, like, it was in the fourth quarter, 7 minutes left, 13-13. You're like, I know it ends 26-20. How are they going to get these next two scores? 7 minutes, or, you know, the Bears score with, like, 3 minutes left. I'm like, oh, my God, this is great. How are they going to score? They're going to score another touchdown. How are they going to do this in 3 minutes?
It actually puts a lot in perspective. I have found that I have talked about the love of red zone on this. I think it's the best invention in television history, the red zone channel, and being able just to show the scores and jump from. And unfortunately, it has ruined me in the way that I don't like commercials. So when the Bears game goes to commercial, and there were five or six people watching the game at my brother's house, like, hey, put red zone on. And then it becomes like,
yeah.
Like, you're just watching. You forget the game's on. And then, like, the Bears will pop up on red zone going, Cutler moving them. And you're like, all right, well, I got enough Bears. And they're like, let's go back to the Jets and Giants. You're like, I'll watch that game. And so I missed, like, a good swath of the middle of the game accidentally. Like, it wasn't because I was, like, rushing to get somewhere. I was on the couch. It's just, like, there are more interesting games going on. The Bears didn't – there were a lot of field goals and a pick six, which was shown on red zone. So you're like, eh. And that – I mean, so it's a different way to watch the game. So I feel like I missed a lot. I did come back for the end of the game. Eddie Goldman.
Great.
Well, I mean, first round pick – or second round pick right at the top there. Amazing game. I mean, he was, like – he had this, like – aura about him, whereas the first time I felt like the defensive tackle position for the Chicago Bears was back to, like, Tommy Harris.
Yeah, it's like four sacks this year already, and as a
but just
run
that
stuffer.
Game yesterday, it was like when it counted, when it was that mucky kind of Chicago Soldier Field turf, and you're like, you got to stop him. He was making plays.
Yeah, I read on Adam Hoag's blog at WGNRadio.com that he graded highest out of all the Bears.
Absolutely, I felt like 91 and 50. Shea McClellan was the same thing. Like, I felt like he was in the plays, like he was always around the ball. And even though he made a huge mistake to lose the game, the safety, Amos, is another one who he likes to put his head in stuff. And you feel like, you know, for once you're starting to there feels like there's a character to the Bears defense. Like they have that kind of like we packed a lunch pail and we're gonna do our job.
Yep.
And that's, I guess, it's funny to think it's only a blink of an eye. It's been a year turnaround from that weird experiment where we're like, let's be offense and dance and throw the ball around. And we're all like, I guess that's what everybody does. But we're, you know, and then they're like, defense is so yesterday. And then we watch like the worst defensive performances in the history of the NFL. Ugh. And you're like, I don't want to be like this. I want to go back to rock and roll. Lunchtime. Got my pail. 3 and out, gonna be 6-3. That's what you want, right? And so I feel like that's where I feel we're getting back to, like, all is well in Chicago.
Yeah, great. I mean, yeah, Matt Forte had an awesome game. Langford had an awesome game. They really ran the ball. I mean, San Francisco's they're not the big run-stopping team, but it was fun to see.
There were, like, 26 injuries.
Yeah, man, it was.
So it was hard. Every time a guy went down, they're like, let's take a commercial break. I'm like, no! Red zone.
So, red zone's the best, especially if you play fantasy football. Oh, I mean, I think that's what it was made for, is for people that.
Yeah.
And as I was watching the taped game, they were showing highlights, and I was like, I can't tell you any of the scores of the other games, even though I saw every single highlight. I was just like, I'm not interested in that game because I don't have a guy playing.
And it's really weird because, like, you'll watch the Blitz on ESPN, like, at night, and you're like, oh, that's what happened in that game?
Yeah.
Because all I know is Chicandrick West scored a touchdown.
Right, exactly.
I couldn't tell you anything else about the drama of the game except that Jeremy Maclin had 6 catches for 92 yards.
That guy who hosts the Red Zone is good, too, because there's some times where there's, like, 4 games and nothing's happening, and he just presents it really, really well. There might be a penalty, a commercial, you know, halftime and something else, and he really just sets the table
he's
really
great
well.
He's great, too, because he'll always say he rips on the networks. So they'll show, like, something inside of Red Zone of, like, a flashback or, like, let's get a game break. And they're like, play we showed 20 minutes ago. And really stay on top of that one, Fox. Like, it's really fun how he does that. Like, he's always on top of it. So, anyway, Bears lose. Our hopes and dreams are dashed for 2015. I guess we'll wait to 2016. Mm-hmm. All right, that's going to do it for the download. Coming up pretty late with Patty Vasquez, but no Patty tonight. Instead, we have Hannah Stanley and Mark Harmon that are in. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Happy holidays to you, Justin.
Happy
and you,
holidays
Hannah.
To you. So what do we got tonight? What are you guys doing? What's the plan?
Is there any news today?
None. No.
Slowest day ever.
There is no news. We are actually going to do a recap, though, of something that happened to me over the weekend that I'm still sore from.
What happened?
I ran without being chased, which has never happened before, ever.
I love that.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
I didn't know that until this very moment, and now I'm really excited for the show.
I don't want to give away the show, but I'm like, was it outside? Was it an outside run?
Yes, it was. Oh. And we have the founders of the Santa Speedo Run Boys Town here, and they're
so
gonna...
this was like an organized run.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I thought this was just like a normal run.
No,
like me,
I'm
I get on the
go out and run. No, I actually I had them in to promote the run, and I said I would do it. Which was stupid, and then I made a tutu. Carmen saw me in it. There was a tutu involved.
It was uncomfortable.
I have to ask. I mean, are you not an avid runner? You just said, okay, I'll do it.
No. And then I tried to figure out how to do it because I'm smart enough to realize maybe I should have gotten out of this or not volunteered in the first place. But sure, I'll make a costume. This will be fun. And so I dressed up like a sugar plum fairy because it was a Nutcracker theme.
Sure.
And I made a plum and silver sparkle. There is glitter throughout this area because there was a lot of tutu and tulle. There are 26 yards of tulle involved. But I started doing a couch to 5K running program.
Okay.
And
all right,
so,
good.
Yeah, now
that was
I'm
a little bit worried. I'm like, I would have done your celebrity. If I were you, I would have been like, I'm a celebrity. I show up at the end. I walk in and I just kind of like half walk past the line and go, yay.
That's because I'm not a celebrity.
No, you are. So you just need to be like, oh, thank you to everybody. You do a speech and then you're out and it looks like you ran it.
You wear your WGN hat, Hannah.
Right.
And that's all you got to do.
That means I'm going to have to go make one because nobody's given me one. So I wore a tutu and I was a sugar plum fairy.
Wow. Well,
but we're going to recap.
I can't wait to hear. That's great.
Because they did incredible, incredible things for Center on Halstead.
And Mark, you were not at the Bulls game tonight.
I was not, but I did do a spin class on Sunday morning to try to compete with Hannah.
We had to get in shape because Patty's the big CrossFitter.
She is. You have to keep up, man.
Oh,
she's very, very...
her and Guth, I had to do something to keep in shape to compete with those two girls.
Right. I'm the guy who gets on one of the ellipticals at the gym, and I go, 1, 2, and then I look around to see if anyone's looking. I go, 9, 10, oh. And then I wait on the machine for like 6 minutes, and with the towels down, and I do it again, I do less.
See, that's who I have the most respect for. Anybody who actually gets on the elliptical with no music and no something that they can look at that excites them in front of them and somehow does 40 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever it is, I don't think I can ever do that. I really don't think that'll ever happen for me.
I'm so old school. When I work out, I power walk. I'm a power walker on the treadmill. So, like, I don't run.
Are you
because
a vlogger?
I just get that thing going about 4. You know, I get going. And then there's always inevitably there'll be one guy who comes right next to me and he's like, he gets on there and then he just jacks it like to the fastest it could possibly go and then runs like he's running up a mountain.
Yeah.
And you just feel so inadequate. You just feel like, I'm just walking.
Yeah, that's why I had to do a program because I got the headphones in and they tell me what to do. It's a nice British chick.
And you
She's
run
like,
fast.
Prepare to run. And I'm like, okay, I'll do whatever you want. So, that's what I do. I run as fast as I can for a little bit of time.
Good show,
by the way.
We'll see you tomorrow.